Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Bernadine Sung Magazine with Compass Real Estate, serving buyers and sellers throughout Greater Boston. Learn more at homesbybernadine.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, for the immunocompromised, as well as those of us worried about the long-term effectiveness of those initial COVID-19 shots, boosters are the next step to living outside the shadow of coronavirus. But leaders at both the FDA and CDC are calling on the Biden administration to pump the brakes. We'll ask medical ethicist Art Kaplan if they are right, and we'll talk to him about the Texas abortion law, and then we'll ask you, if you're upset about what Texas just did, what are you going to do about it?
Then after 2 decades lost in Afghanistan, BU historian Andrew Bacevich thinks it's finally time for Americans to admit that our age of military supremacy is over. Instead of positioning ourselves as the dominant global leader, would the U.S. be better off tackling our pressing domestic issues, like our response to climate change? Bacevich says maybe it's time. We're almost out of it. That's coming up ahead on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
You and I made it in 2 days in a row. Pretty incredible, isn't it?
We're unbelievable.
We are on a roll. In any case, while the Supreme Court's conservative majority was swiftly signaling the end of Roe v. Wade by upholding the ruthless Texas abortion law, a judge in Ohio is busy protecting hospital patients from latest crackpot COVID treatment, livestock deworming medicine. Join us online to talk through these judicial moves and other medical ethical headlines. Art Kaplan. Art is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City, and the man who received a 9 out of 10 from RoomRaider.com. Are you going to correct the 10% that caused you not to be perfect, Art?
I thought they were wrong. They wanted a little more light, and I thought it was lit up pretty good.
It was,
so, no.
File an appeal.
I'll take it.
So, Art Kaplan, you do have a very impressive room, that beautiful bookshelves. The most beautiful bookshelves I've seen, except for Anderson Cooper's, whose are really impressive. The two of you are in a battle.
Yeah, but I wrote the ones in my library.
Oh. Very good. Touché, Art. So let's get back to this new abortion legislation in Texas. The Association of Doctors there is condemning the abortion ban, calling it a vigilante interference in a doctor-patient relationship. I know the AMA has made a statement. What do you make of this as a medical ethicist, and should the medical community, the pretty trusted, I think, reasonably trusted medical community, make more of a big deal about this? Because it could spread to other states very quickly.
Well, you know, there's a kind of parallel situation going on. The Texas government has decided to intervene in medical care with respect to abortion, and we've got judges issuing orders around the country to doctors to prescribe something that has no evidence that it works for COVID. So what they want is to give it to a COVID patient who's very sick as a therapy. Anybody who was an ivermectin dewormer proponent had always said it might be good to prevent getting COVID. I don't think there's any data for that either that's reliable, but there's certainly nothing for therapy. So in both cases, I think what you got to do is organize resistance. I've told doctors, if you get a court order to give ivermectin from a doctor who's not practicing in your hospital, refuse it. Don't honor it. They have no privileges. They can't dictate care when they're not licensed or credentialed at your hospital or nursing home, wherever it might be. I think it's risky. Sure, the court could decide to try and enforce it, but then you're going to go to court and say, they're making me give a futile, ridiculous, unsubstantiated intervention. I'm not doing that. And I don't think you're going to lose that argument. It's a pain in the neck to have to fight it, but one other comment about dewormer medicine for COVID. Some people sort of say, well, when they're terminally ill, give them anything. I've heard a number of proponents of this online saying, you know, try everything. But, you know, my mom gave me ginger ale and Vicks VapoRub. should we be doing that for terminally ill people? That was her remedy for sickness. By the way, it worked. I'm still here, so I've survived many ailments. But you know what I mean. You don't decide what doctors should be doing by taking a vote on the internet and then demanding that some judge order it.
You know, by the way, in a related note, since you had a pain in the neck, I've been wearing a flea collar the last couple of weeks. Do you think, is that a mistake? Or is, okay, forget, let's move on. Can we get back to Texas for a second? I want to follow up on what Marjorie asked you, though. I don't understand when there is such grotesque interference in the relationship between a patient and her doctor. Isn't there, or is there more that that the medical community, individual doctors and doctors' organizations can do other than just like the AMA said, it's deeply disturbing? And I mean, is there something they can do? Is there something they should do other than speak out? Or am I barking up the wrong tree?
Well, I don't think, you know, my attitude has been medicine, healthcare, science has not adequately spoken up for decades about abortion issues. And I'll just focus in on one area where I think they've been cowards. That heartbeat bill, 6 weeks, that says, okay, we're going to recognize fetal life there. If you or Marjorie or I had a heartbeat and no brain activity, you know what we would be called?
Yeah.
Dead.
Yeah.
If there is just a heartbeat and nothing else is going on, there's no brain activity. And why doesn't medicine speak out about this? Mm-hmm. You're taking a primitive heart function. It's not even really able to supply anything to a brain. There is no brain yet. Make the points that the biology isn't consistent with these laws at all. And yes, I think they should be tougher. They should be filing their own lawsuits. They should be screaming about interference with the women-patient relationship. I just don't think they're taking a tough enough stand. I really don't. And they haven't for a long time because it's been controversial.
Well, you know, there's a great line which surprised me because I fell for this fetal heartbeat thing, hook, line, and sinker, not knowing that they're kind of spinning this. The Texas Tribune has a piece about physicians and the fetal heartbeat. And it says that calling this a heartbeat is inaccurate since embryos at 6 weeks do not possess a heart.
Right. They have a little tube.
Yeah.
But
Right. So a phrase that I'm embarrassed to say I've used a million times about fetal heartbeats, apparently at 6 weeks is untrue and irrelevant and not correct.
And where is the medical profession, the science profession, to call out false embryology?
Yeah.
False claims about what a fetus looks like at 6 weeks. Look, people don't like Roe versus Wade for a variety of reasons, but I'm going to tell you one point that it did arrive at: viability. And if you don't have lungs, which fetuses at 6 weeks most certainly do not, they can't survive outside the woman's body. If there's no brain activity at all, we would consider anybody in that state not to exist. I know I'm repeating myself, but it's always angered me. We don't hear corrections of the facts about embryos and fetuses in all this debate. And so people can come out and say, well, there's a fetal heartbeat. There isn't.
Yeah.
It's not developed yet. It's just, I don't even think it's significant, by the way. That's not the landmark I would go to, since we look at brain activity as the level you go to when you're trying to decide who's alive and who's dead. But come on, let's speak up more about what the facts are.
Well, you know, we should also point out that many people who are pro-life make exceptions for rape and incest because obviously the horror scenario is that some 11-year-old girl is impregnated by her father and is forced to carry that baby to term. But in Texas, this seems to be basically okay with the governor, who gave kind of a ridiculous answer when asked about this. We've got some sound.
Well, by the way, we should be clear. It's not okay with the governor. The law does not exempt. Does not make exceptions for rape or incest, period. Well, that's the law.
Well, that makes it okay, in my money, for a child of an incest situation to have to give birth. Because he gives a ridiculous answer. So here he is. Here's Texas Governor Greg Abbott in response to a question about why he allowed the abortion law to pass so restrictively that it would not allow rape and incest victims to terminate unwanted pregnancies.
It doesn't require that at all because, obviously, it provides at least 6 weeks for a person to be able to get an abortion. And so, for one, it doesn't provide that. That said, however, let's make something very clear. Rape is a crime, and Texas will work tirelessly to make sure that we eliminate all rapists from the streets of Texas by aggressively going out and arresting them and prosecuting them and getting them off the streets.
Now, maybe if the governor were a woman, he would understand that a lot of 11-year-old girls don't know their, or those few people that get pregnant at a very young age may not know they're pregnant until they're about 7 months along. Never mind 6 weeks. It's a ridiculous answer. And obviously, your rapist would not even be coming to trial before you were giving birth. So it's
Wait a second. He's also saying we're going to eradicate rape. I mean, it is so.
Well, see, both of you are not with it. That's okay. The problem in responding to this. Clearly, what you do is you go to each community and you say, monitor the thoughts of your neighbors. If you see men who look like they're getting lusty or having impure desires, you report them to us. We'll give you the $10,000 bounty that we built into this bill to rat out your neighbor anyway, and we'll be good. It just takes a little thought monitoring by, you know, the local community to pick up the pre-rapist state. I mean, that what the governor said, to quote John Stuart Mill or paraphrase him, is stupid on stilts. But the whole law is ridiculous because I was trying to point out for those listeners who don't know, it relies on a community bounty system
bounty
to turn
hunters,
in
yeah.
people who abet abortion. Are you kidding me? Mao Zedong in his communist Chinese purification by the community policies couldn't have gone that far. This is, how can a conservative in good faith say, rat out your neighbor for a bounty and report him to the state authorities? Where's the conservative aspect of that?
But the problem here, Art, is that the United States Supreme Court is letting this stand. So,
I know, and
other states may use this that are in control of Republican legislatures. And by the way, I think there's 13 women of the 100 Republicans in the Texas legislature. So, you know, we're more than half the population, but 13 out of 100 or some people in that legislature. So this could become the law of many other states with Republican-controlled legislatures.
And I'm sure that you will see bills within the next week or two mimicking the Texas one. But it is unconstitutional, I don't know, maybe for about 350 reasons. It's not respecting precedent. The fetal heartbeat thing comes out of nowhere. Fetal heartbeat thing has no justification as a important landmark. The bounty hunting, rat out your neighbor thing seems to me to be unconstitutional in terms of rights of citizens, not to have to worry about getting chased down by the abortion posse in your town. And, you know, it just seems to me it won't hold even with that conservative court. They're going to have to come. That's not the law that's going to make it. Something might, but I don't think this thing will.
Well, yeah, by the way, if I just can correct, you know, I mean, I'm with you both, needless to say. The Constitution says whatever the Supreme Court says it says. If five of these people, led by Clarence Thomas, says there's no right to privacy in the Constitution, that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided, then Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. I mean, so we can all suggest, and I think we all do, it is so clearly the Texas law, SB 8, is it, flies in the face of this 50-year-old precedent. But those men and women have the power to
and
say
I'll
that.
And I'll give you a small effort at a legal lecture. This is me lecturing the lawyer. But it's not just Roe v. Wade. There's a ton of these cases, and indeed a whole umbrella of privacy protection that hinges on these cases that had nothing to do with abortion. Mm-hmm. You think that you're going to be able to keep your cell phone information private if they kick out Roe v. Wade? You won't, because privacy evaporates. You won't have it anywhere. So to just chuck out not just Roe v. Wade, but 50 years of repeated decisions saying there's privacy, even if you want to try to argue it's not in the Constitution, although there's a lot of things not in the Constitution, I think Ben Franklin would have been a little sad to find us still trying to follow a Constitution written, you know, 300 years ago to guide today's lifestyle. But be that as it may, If you want to be an originalist and kick it out, you're going to tear down just an enormous amount of law with regard to privacy.
You know, one last thing about this. Remember in the good old days, Art, we used to talk about how we're not going to have to worry about protests at abortion clinics because so many young women would be getting abortion pills mm-hmm. in the mail, that the governor mm-hmm. in Texas has outlawed those as well. So you're no longer going to get the pills in the mail.
And by the way,
has that been signed into law? By the way, is that signed into law yet, or is that? I know that's. Maybe you're right. I know it's something that he's advancing. I'm just not sure if it's already law. We'll check in a second.
I believe he has.
Yeah, by the way, while you're looking at that, efforts to restrict that kind of telemedicine are also going to hit, what is it, all those gentlemen who want to order their erectile dysfunction pills remotely. There's a slew of commerce in healthcare things. I don't think it's going to stand up just to single out abortion pills. So I think you're going to wind up getting blowback from industries that rely for sale of, what about 23andMe? What about all those genetic testing companies? They're happy to see the Texas legislature, if it did it, step in and ban commerce in a particular thing. Boy, that's going to be a war.
We're talking to Art Kaplan. Art, can we spend a few minutes on COVID? There is a Brian Stelter, who's the media guy for CNN, has a wonderful newsletter that comes out at midnight every night. And the lead of today's newsletter is a rather extensive discussion with some people for whom I have a lot of respect, saying we're about to move from pandemic to endemic phase. The basic argument, to reduce it to its simplest form, is despite all the scary stuff we've been hearing about Delta and breakthrough infections and that sort of thing, we have to sort of... this is sort of like our discussion with Andrew Sullivan a couple of weeks ago, Marjorie, before we went on vacation. We have to begin treating this like the flu. Vaccinated people, particularly in liberal states, some of them are saying, are overreacting to the current wave of things, and it's time to calm down and, again, treat this like an endemic situation rather than a pandemic. Are you there or are you not?
Oh, I'm not. But on the other hand, I would say maybe half the country is. You don't have to urge them to do it. They are doing it. Did you all both pay attention to football activities?
Marjorie.
Oh, my gosh.
It was like...
Florida State, you know, Notre Dame.
Unbelievable.
You know, it was like the virus party of America. So we have a lot of people who've given up and basically just said that you don't need that encouragement. They've already done it. They're not masking. They go where they want. They have given up, I'm going to say. And I would say the South, more or less, the government has given up in terms of prevention, right? They're offering you antibodies and dewormer. So that's the sort of giving up. But two reasons not to do this. One, it's one thing to accept flu-level deaths. There were probably, in most years, 10,000. You know, we're over 650,000 in 18 months here. It's quite different to say, well, you know, we'll have to accept basically 500,000 deaths a year as long as this thing rattles around. I don't know about those guys, but I'm not ready to go there yet. The other reason I don't agree with this is the world is still not vaccinated. There's going to be more mutants, and some of them might jump after the vaccines that we have. We got to continue to develop better vaccines, and that call to just give in and live with it, and, you know, those who die will die, I think is, it's like saying, you know, cancer, it costs us a ton of money to treat it. Why don't we just give up?
Yeah.
Build hospices and let them go. They die at about the same rate.
So are the other...
I just want to clarify on the Texas abortion bill. The legislature has advanced the bill. Abbott has not yet signed it, but he's indicated he will.
Okay, great. I mean, not great, but thanks for the update. Boosters, for a second. It seems to me that one of the most important things in a divided nation over science and public health like this is the message of our leaders should be clear and consistent. It seems to me that the Biden administration, and again, he's giving a big speech tomorrow. I don't know what's in it. Maybe you know mm-hmm. what his 6 points are going to be. They have totally butchered this booster thing, it seems to me, which I worry trickles down into other aspects of vaccinations. Am I overreacting to what they've done here or no?
No, I don't think so. I think the messaging went, boosters are coming. Boosters are coming in 8 months. Boosters are coming in 6 months. Everybody who's older might need a booster. Oh, never mind. Pull that back. We're ahead of the data. we'll wait for the FDA. I mean, you can't do it that way. By the way, here's another gripe. I'm not sure it's a booster. It might be a three-shot vaccine.
Yeah, that's what Fauci's saying. Yeah.
When you get HPV vaccinations, three shots. When you get a Hep B vaccine, three shots. And as we know, shingles for old folks, two shots. So there are many. My point being, I think what's happened is you get a three-shot vaccine. We didn't really test it that way because we were in a hurry. If you call it a booster, it sounds selfish. I'm going to go get something when others haven't gotten something. If you say it's a three-shot vaccine and that's what everybody needs to get strong immunity for a long period of time, then that's public policy, so to speak. So I'm not a fan of this booster language at all. I may have been able to convince or catch Fauci's ear on this, but I've been screaming, it's a three-shot vaccine. By the way, one other problem, as long as I'm ranting on this, we've got to keep researching vaccines. We need better vaccines. We're all in love with the ones we have. They're nice. They helped us a lot. But it would be nice to have a vaccine that lasted 5 years. It would be nice to have a one-shot vaccine. And it's hard to do the research ethically because now you've got to test the new vaccines against the existing ones. That takes years to get the data. Remember my moaning about challenge studies? Trying new vaccines on people just direct. I think you got to do some of that.
You know, there are two last things I have on this booster thing, Art. One, do you have any insight on the question that a lot of our listeners are asking, which is we know that Pfizer will be the first of the vaccines that will have a booster or third shot authorized. If you got a Moderna or a J&J as your first round, is there any reason you can't? Is there any evidence that you can or cannot do the Pfizer as your second shot if you're J&J or third shot if you're Moderna? Do you know?
Nobody knows.
Okay.
There's just not a pile of data on that because we didn't do those switches. I think, oddly enough, England tried some second shot switching, but they used AstraZeneca, so it isn't even the one that we had here. Sorry, folks. I don't think we know the answer.
And last thing from me is a lot of the people who have been upset about the booster issue are not just upset about the mixed messaging, but there are a lot of people in the public health world who say the more we focus on boosters, the less we focus on the much more important issue, which is getting the 25% of adults in this country who haven't even had one shot get their shot. I sort of subscribe to that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, even though we haven't proven we can walk or chew gum. where are you on that issue that it distracts
I think you can do both. The one thing that's true, if you look at the supply of vaccine that's in the U.S., we got enough to do that. Sometimes people say, well, you should try to use some of it to vaccinate overseas. But I think that doesn't make any sense because it's a drop in the bucket right now for overseas. It would make a bigger dent here to get first and second vaccinations done. I'm going to say it again. I think it's a three-shot vaccine, and I think what we're going to learn is you got to do them all in order to get immunity. Talk about boosters is not the same as talking about finish the series of what's required.
I agree with that.
All right, Kathleen, we only have a minute left, but I want to this is not an ethical question, but you're my go-to guy in everything having to do with COVID, so why not ask you while you're here? Jim and I were talking about this before the show. There's a certain strain of writing that's coming out now that's saying people that are vaccinated, especially in states like Massachusetts, where most people are vaccinated, we have a very good rate here, should relax a little bit because the worst we're going to get is a mild case of COVID, although I have been reading about long-haul COVID, which I'd like to avoid. So should I relax a little bit more, just kind of que sera, sera? Or what should I do?
I'm going to say no, partly because you can still transmit even if you're vaccinated, so you want to watch out for kids and immune compromised people and transplants and folks who have cancer whose immune systems are weak. I also think sometimes we're not quite sure when our immunity right now is wearing off, so before we settle this third shot thing, I would still be a little bit cautious. Now, do I worry about eating outdoors? Do I worry about running around, the streets of Framingham, jogging and so on? No, I don't worry about that as much. I'm still watching the indoor spaces, the crowds, where kids might be. If I'm visiting the nursing home, I still want a mask. I don't want to kill them there even if I'm vaccinated. So, I don't know, 10%, a little bit of release, if you will, or a little bit self-congratulation for doing better.
Let me just end
but no,
this.
I wouldn't hang up the mask yet.
Yeah, okay. I wouldn't hang it up yet. And I'm not a doctor or an ethicist. Let me just say, you can be a lot more relaxed than Marjorie and Art if you're wearing that Jim and Marjorie flea collar. So try it out. If it won't work for everybody, it has relieved a lot of stress for me.
And by the way, if you can't get one, go to court and demand that you be given such thing in the ICU.
Really? Where's that Gwyneth Paltrow on this? Hasn't she invented some kind of candle or some internal
to
vaginal
stick it up
treatment?
Your you-know-what, exactly.
All right, thank you very much.
Great to talk to you as always. Be well.
Thank you.
Art Kaplan joins us every week, and we're so glad he does. He's a doctor. He's William Meff, a Virginia Commonly MIDI professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. Thanks again to Art Kaplan. Okay, coming up, we are taking your calls asking you about corporate America's silence on the Texas abortion ban. Could boycotting businesses be one action you could take right now to fight this law? You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Marjorie Egan, as I was saying, welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. From Black Lives Matter to breast cancer awareness, corporate America has shown its support and made a show of it. Most recently, Texas-based businesses like Dell, Hewlett-Packard, American Airlines publicly condemned GOP voting bills in that state. On most issues, corporate America is quick to calculate what it means to be on the right side of history. The Texas abortion law, however, has rendered much, if not most, of corporate America mum. American Airlines, AT&T, Exxon, among other big businesses that are either based in Texas or have expanded their operations in the state, have said nothing. A couple of outliers have weighed in on the law. Texas-based dating sites like Bumble, Match Group are taking actions or speaking out against the law. The CEO of Lyft tweeted that he plans to create a driver defense fund to cover legal fees for drivers and that the company will donate $1 million to Planned Parenthood. So for those of you who also oppose this radical Texas abortion law, could boycotting businesses that are doing nothing on this issue be one way to try to make a difference? The number is 877-301-8970. The answer is a clear and convincing yes, is it not, Marjorie?
Well, you know, sometimes these things work and sometimes they don't work because people lose interest and things
peter out.
Yes, things do peter out. But there are some companies that are doing something. I mean, Uber and Lyft are going to said they cover the legal fees for any drivers that were sued. GoDaddy told the Texas Right to Life to find a different provider for this ProLifeWhistleblower.com, a site that invites supporters of this law to report people. This is from the Washington Post. Tesla and Oracle are still, as far as we know, planning to move to Texas. We'll see if that changes. But there are other corporations like Facebook, who, of course, have not replied to inquiries from reporters. Dallas-based Southwest declined to comment. So did Hewlett-Packard. Both of them moved to Texas, and other corporations that have large workforces. Again, this is from the Washington Post in Texas. Amazon, Apple, Google, Kimberly-Clark, and AT&T did not respond to their inquiries from the Washington Post.
I think it'd be a lot shorter if you just said virtually no corporations, with the exception of a couple of ride-sharing companies and a couple of dating sites, have said a damn thing because they're nervous about getting involved in the issue. And I have to say, you're right, a lot of movements peter out. But it seems to me that the vast majority of what's being done by people who are appalled by this appalling law and the appalling decision by the Supreme Court are taking to social media, which, you know, please, how about doing a little something? And if you can attempt to have some impact with your pocketbook and announce that you're making, on social media, by the way, that decision with your pocketbook, so be it. And by the way, as you mentioned to me this morning, there is a women's march, I guess the second following the one after Trump's election in 2017 on October 2nd.
Well, there have been several.
Both in Washington.
Remember?
But I mean,
huge. That was the first one.
Yeah. On October 2nd in both D.C. and hopefully in 50 states. I think this boycott thing is a terrific idea. Everybody can participate. everybody uses one or more of these companies for something.
Right.
And they should be forced to take a position.
Well, the problem is, Jim, we've been talking about endlessly giving up Amazon. You'd have to give up your Amazon. You have to give up your Apple computer, phone, everything else you've got, iPad, everything else you've got.
How about the Texas-based businesses to start with?
That like would
Dell,
be great.
Especially if they thought it was appropriate to speak out, Dell and American Airlines being two good examples based in Texas. If they both thought it was important enough to speak out on the repressive voting legislation that Texas was considering, then force them to put up or shut up on these abortion laws.
Did we mention the dating sites?
Yeah, okay. I said them and you said them.
Right,
that they are Bumble
sure.
and Match Group
yep.
Have both taken a position on this thing, as should everybody. I mean, this is a huge issue. There's and as we discussed with Art and as we discussed yesterday, I think most people listening, even if you are somebody who does not agree with Roe v. Wade, you can't disagree with the facts. It's been the precedent for 50 years. These Supreme Court justices have talked about how they honor precedent. And it's clear you've got to be a fool to believe that the Texas law does not run afoul of Roe v. Wade.
Well, especially, first of all, according to Gallup, and this has been consistent, 58% of people in a Gallup poll in June do not want to get rid of Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. Only 19% want abortion illegal in all cases. There's a so-called mushy middle, which a longtime Globe columnist, Ellen Goodman, used to talk about. People that get, well, should it really be 6 months? Should it be 24 weeks, which it is under Roe v. Wade? Should it be 20? That kind of discussion goes on, like in the so-called mushy middle, people that don't like abortion, really. Who likes abortion? Nobody likes abortion. But when you're talking about rape and incest, I mean, really, that's like where the Catholic Church is. No exceptions, including rape and incest. You could say it's consistent because it's not the fetus' fault how it got there. But I mean, I think for most people's way of thinking, that is absolutely insane that you're going to make victims of a rape carry their rapist baby to term. Really?
877-301-8970. So if you're upset about what Texas did, if you're upset about what the Supreme Court of the United States did, and I believe is likely to do, for example, when the Mississippi case comes before them. Is that 15 weeks in Mississippi? I can't remember what the number.
15 weeks,
which is before the court in its next term. What are you planning on doing about it other than tweeting your dissatisfaction? Let's go to Devin in Franklin. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call. Hi.
Hey guys, how you doing?
We're good.
I really appreciate the opportunity to come on because I've been listening to you guys for a while. My mom really loves you guys too. So
I just didn't know
if you guys had heard. Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate what you guys do a lot. I didn't know if you guys had heard the Boston Globe earlier today had actually had an article about Grendel's Den, which was a liquor license.
Well, it was an op-ed by the lawyer, probably the preeminent constitutional lawyer in America, Larry Tribe, talking about the case. We talked about it with the woman who owns Grendel's Den a couple of months ago. Why don't you describe what the piece says, Devin?
So, yeah, I mean, it goes into essentially a few different sections, one which kind of goes into how the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871 kind of protected civil rights for previously enslaved Americans, obviously, who were being targeted by extrajudicial violence is what they kind of put it as. And what I find is fascinating is not just that, but it also, of course, with Grendel's Den case, there is a precedent. I'm glad that you guys are talking about precedents because, to me, I feel like it's important that we don't just discuss, like with your previous caller, of course, not just the precedent of Roe versus Wade, but the precedent of other laws that our country has kind of enacted or kind of followed suit with previously. And one thing that I found fascinating about what they say is that in the Grendel's Den case, it was really a church trying to veto a liquor license.
That's
so
correct.
It was almost less of an infringement from a personal standpoint on someone else's rights than something like that would be. So I do think it's important, at least for, you know, the discussion to be out there because it does allow people the precedent to be able to possibly even sue or countersue people who sue them for that $10,000 bounty, which I found was an incredibly interesting point of the article.
Well, I mean, I think the primary point is that they would have to overrule two precedents to find that the Texas law is constitutionally permissible, not only Roe v. Wade, But as you say, the precedent that was set in this Grendel's Den case and relying on these Ku Klux Klan laws. Devin, we're glad you called. People should read it. Larry Tribe, again, it was the lead lawyer in this this Grendel's Den, which is a restaurant in Harvard Square, I should say, and still is a restaurant in Harvard Square. You should read the piece. I think it's useful. That assumes, by the way, the Supreme Court cares about what the law is. And
well, you know, I don't know, you know, if the Supreme Court, as we've pointed out, these last three judges have been darlings of the Federal Society, and one of the purposes of their getting them on the court is to overturn Roe v. Wade. Art from West Bridgeport is one of conservative listeners, thinks that the GNC might be paying the Texas GOP for their fundraising efforts because of this, but he said he thinks this whole thing is a red herring. The fetal heartbeat isn't going to stand. All the Supreme Court did was give an injunction based on a technicality, the filing just when the courts wouldn't hear Republican challenges to the ACA because people hadn't yet been harmed. But I don't know. Maybe Art is right. I am a little bit suspicious given the politics behind the selection and appointments of the last three.
But that's a point.
Judges.
I don't want to spend this next half hour debating the law and what the five justices led by Clarence Thomas decided they didn't give a damn about the law. The question is, what are the American people who are upset about it going to do about it? And is a corporate boycott one of the things that a person can do while they're lying on their couch tweeting? And I would say the answer is yes. 877-301-8970.
I would just like to point out that Texas, where COVID has been raging because of a low vaccination rate relative to other states, including our own, has a governor who has outlawed any kind of mask mandates, even in the schools, to prevent the spread among children, outlawed any kind of vaccination mandate. Forget about that. So we can...
Well, can't you carry guns now with no permits and no training? Isn't that something else he approved in the last couple of days?
I don't know enough about the gun laws in Texas. But this governor has basically said, we can certainly... we can force women. We can't force you to wear a mask. We can't force you to get a vaccine. But we can force women, mm-hmm. even survivors of rape and incest, to carry babies to term. Somehow, that doesn't seem to make logical sense to me. Does it make sense to you, Jim?
No, but unfortunately for America, neither you nor I are on the Supreme Court. Let's go to Nahid in Chelmsford. Most people would disagree with that.
Hello.
Hi, Nahid. Welcome to the welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. I think we're going to the cavemen, and Texicans are not Texicans, they're cavicans. And I asked, I'm originally from Iran, mm-hmm. and I asked my mom if in Iran, even with the stupid government and the mullahs that we have, is abortion is legal? Yes, it is. Imagine that. And here's the other part. My body, my choice. I'm not going to take the vaccine. My body, your choice. I'll keep the baby, and after I deliver it, No deals going on. I have to continue, even if it's a rape. I had an abortion, and I'm so grateful for the time that I had abortion in Oklahoma, and it was from a guy I hated. Thank God.
You know, Nahid, I am so glad you called, because I've often thought if more women had the courage, more particularly women that are well-known, had the courage to say they had abortions, because the rate is very high. This would be different. If more people's mothers and grandmothers and maybe some Republican women in some of these legislatures had the courage to say they had abortions, I think the whole debate would be different. Thank you so much for
that.
That
was a great call, Nahid. Thank you for making it. 877-301-8970.
Davida from Harvard, thank you for calling.
Hello, Davida.
Hello again. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
So I like to think when people say, what do you boycott? I like to say, what do you got? Because I'm a firm believer in boycotting, even on an individual level. So I started my first boycott back in the 70s with Nestle's.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
The whole cooking formula. So
yes.
I didn't eat couldn't have my chocolate bars forever. Still don't buy Nestle's. Boycott Whole Foods, Amazon, most stores that... even if I don't boycott them, I write letters to any and every store or business that I want them to let them know how I feel about all their overuse of plastic and overpackaging and you name it.
God, good for you.
Yeah. So
what's left? Hey, Davita, what can you still buy? Anything?
Well, I go to the co-op in Vermont at Brattleboro, and I buy everything that I can in bulk or glass. So, I'm done without sour cream and cottage cheese. So sad. Ricotta. you name it. I've been the major sacrificer, but I feel better. And I also do a lot of texting, and I email political cartoons to people to voice my opinion. So anyway,
DaVita,
that's how I spend my time when I'm doing other stuff.
DaVita, what's wrong with ricotta cheese? So I have to.
It comes in plastic.
Oh God, right. Oh God, one of my favorite things: ricotta pancakes, DaVita.
Well, you know what I did?
What?
We have a farmer friend, and I actually went and bought some milk from him, and came home and made my own. Did that once. It's a little bit of a haul, but I'll do that again when I need to make some eggplant parmesan or something. So. Yeah, there's a way around everything if you have the...
Yeah, DaVita, Marjorie's going to make homemade ricotta really soon, so I'll call you DaVita, the day she
DaVita
does it.
DaVita should get an award. I am so
DaVita,
impressed.
Thanks.
You put me to shame, DaVita. Oh, my God. That was
thanks
a great...
For the call.
That was a great...
By the way,
we need more DaVitas out there.
Before we take a break, this gun bill, I didn't want to list this, but the gun bill that just became law, I think, on September 1st. If you're 21 years or older in Texas, you can both openly and concealed carry a gun without a permit or without any training.
Right.
So there you go. That is.
And as we said before, when we were talking to our captain, the legislature has moved a bill in Texas, and Abbott is expected to sign it, that would ban medical abortions. That means you get pills. Not medical. Well, I guess you, what do you call them? In any case, it's pills.
Mm-hmm.
You get pills. You don't have to go to the clinic. You get pills, and you can take the pills at home to induce an abortion with very few risks of side effects or problems. Anyway, we're talking about corporate America's silence on the Texas abortion law, asking you if boycotting these businesses or pressuring them to speak out is one way to fight this law. This conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about corporate America's silence on the abortion law in Texas. If they don't respond soon on women's rights, is it time to boycott them, particularly when you factor in that women control roughly 70% of household spending in this country? Or put another way, Marjorie, shouldn't we all be like DaVita, with the exception of the ricotta cheese? 877-301-8897. I have to say, I find boycotting to be an empowering thing, too. And I understand it's sort of like environmental stuff. People say, do I really make a difference? Well, when there are a lot of yous, the answer is you do. And when you divert your spending away from bad behaving businesses to good behaving businesses, I find it to be a really satisfying kind of thing, beyond the fact that it may achieve an important and desired result. So I say, go for it. Research the companies that have particularly have spoken out on other things that have been silent here. American Airlines, AT&T, Exxon, 7-Eleven, Dell Technologies, Oracle, all of which are headquartered in Texas, all of which have chosen to remain silent on a woman's right to choose. Charlene on the road. Hi.
Hi. I agree with the boycott. I had made a commitment that Florida will never see a dollar of my vacation money anymore.
Good.
And Texas, I think, from small companies on up, I will make a list and I'll research. For example, the Magnolia Corporation, you know, Waco, Texas has Chip and Joe Gaines, and they've done everything. Well, you know what? You start boycotting them and their products, which are in every Target, et cetera, up to the big people. And then also going to be donating as much money as I can to Planned Parenthood and ask them to put it to Texas.
Charlene, thank you for sharing your actions with us.
Yeah, we have another great boycotter. Christine just sent us a list from the top 25 Fortune 500 companies headquartered in Texas. If you go to www.concordia.edu, yeah, you will find those 25 top Fortune 500 companies.
Well,
you
should check out to see if any of them are doing the right thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't know. The ones we know about, the Dallas Southwest Airlines has not commented. And Hewlett Packard, which moved to Texas last year, has not commented. So we don't know what they're doing.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Rhode Island, where Wendy's on the phone. Hey, Wendy.
Hi.
Hi.
This is indirectly about boycotting, but this is with, first of all, I was one of the founders in 1975 of the New Bedford Women's Center.
Oh,
good for you.
And although we didn't do abortions there, we did do abortion referrals. And I was, you know, in my position as one of the founders and the president of the board there, I was on a lot of, you know, talk radio shows. And I can remember one guy calling in, you know, extremely irate, cussing us out and everything because we were murdering babies. And my answer to him was, excuse me, sir, can you tell me absolutely without equivocation that every time in your entire life you have had sex, that you have not been deliberately trying to create a child, that you used a condom? And, you know, he said, but I'm married. I said, it doesn't make any difference. Can you tell me that you have every single time used a condom? And he blustered around. I said, then I'm sorry, sir. You have no right to even have an opinion. And
love that.
We got a lot of calls from that. But the other thing that I wanted to bring up, and I may be wrong on this, but isn't there a legal precedent for body autonomy that you cannot be forced to donate an organ, even if you're the only person in the world that can save this one poor child with your organ? You cannot be forced to donate an organ. And if you donate organs after death, you have to have a release. I mean, people can't just take your organs. And so I would think that that would be applied to not being forced to give birth to a baby for whatever reason.
Wendy, I don't know what the answer to that. Well, clearly you can't be forced to donate an organ. But putting that aside, you don't need to come up with a convoluted legal argument. There's something called Roe v. Wade, which has been the law of the land for 50 years. And all that has to happen is the precedent has to be honored and the will of the American people has to be honored, which this Supreme Court seems to be willing to fly in the face of quite regularly. Wendy, thanks for that history. That's pretty impressive. And thanks for sharing it with us. 877-301-8970 is our number.
Let's go to Betty in the car. Betty, thank you for calling.
Hi, Betty.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Great, thank you.
Guys, for a couple of months, my husband's a big fan.
Oh, thanks.
Onto it, so. But I used to work for Dell.
Oh.
And typically, Michael Dell is always on the right side of these issues. So it's surprising to not see him come forward. When Trump did something on anti-gay rights, he made a statement to the company. When the voting thing happened, he made a statement to the company. So it's really surprising to see him not doing that.
So before you go ahead, what's your analysis of that?
I don't know. I don't know if he's waiting. He's a pretty thoughtful guy. He thinks things through. So we'll see if he comes forward. He may be waiting to see what happens. I also think that this is going to backfire on Abbott because his disapproval rating is 52% after this, with most Texans thinking he's on the wrong track.
Well, you know, it's great. And I think a lot of people think these people are on the wrong track. But one of the problems that we're dealing with, and we've talked about this a lot, is the rigging of the vote by these Republican legislatures, including in Texas. So they've passed
Absolutely.
This incredibly difficult voting rights ban. So you think it could be one of those situations where even if a Democrat wins convincingly, they won't because of the way the state is gerrymandered or because of the way the vote is being suppressed. It's pretty scary stuff.
Or the way the vote is being counted. I mean, with the ability of legislatures to make ultimate decisions. Betty, thanks for your call and thank your husband and you both for listening. Karen, you are next from Cambridge and you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Jim and Marjorie, for
sure.
having this discussion. Very quickly, I do understand why corporations are reluctant to touch a hot button issue like abortion. But when we boycott and write to these corporations, I suggest that people focus on the vigilantism that is in that law, turning neighbor on neighbor to become a reporter on women's bodies, to go after them for money. I mean, the awfulness of that. We don't like vigilante culture here. We haven't liked it for a long time. And I think that would be very effective. And then the people, the corporation would say, well, we don't touch the abortion issue, but the vigilante issue they can touch and should.
You know, that so may get that, you know, Karen, you may be right that it's a politically less fraught angle or approach this on. But don't you think the right is so fundamental and so basic that these corporate leaders should just belly up to the bar and do the right thing, even if it means it may cost them a little bit of their business?
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think that I'm trying to find ways to enable them to do the right thing without having to touch hot button issues.
Understood.
And
understood.
Out of it.
Karen, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. Thanks so much for calling.
877-301. Oh, no, we're out of time, aren't we?
We are.
Yeah, a lot of people. Davida, by the way, that was talking about how she gets even her own ricotta cheese and makes it. She texted, emailed back to say she, during her travels cross-country several years ago, they all avoided spending money in red states as much as possible. And she sends us a slogan, Jim.
Which is?
Persist, resist, insist, coexist. How like that?
And make your own ricotta. By the way, I would start counting if I were a listener here on the number of days till Marjorie makes her own ricotta. And we'll be the first to tell you. You'll be the first to know.
I think the Women's March thing could be very effective October 2nd.
October 2nd,
too.
Right.
That could be very effective. It's going to be based in Washington, but it's going to be all across the country.
But this is something you can do every day and not
correct.
Wait for October 2nd. While I've been critical of using social media and doing nothing else, you do a boycott and then announce it on public, on social media. And it magnifies your decision, which I think is a terrific way to go.
Okay, coming up 20 years after 9/11, what did the war on terror actually accomplish? Historian Andrew Basevich joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. Historian Andrew Basevich will join us on the lessons America has not learned from our foreign wars. Then nearly 40 years ago, a string of drunk driving accidents led state leaders to ban bars and restaurants from offering happy hour drink specials, making the Commonwealth an American outlier. But State Representative Mike Connolly thinks it's time to rethink our rigid approach to drink deals, particularly if it translates to boosted revenue for struggling restaurants. Representative Connolly will join us to discuss his latest bill and why he thinks now is the time.
In 2015, NPR investigative reporter Laura Sullivan looked into the $500 million the Red Cross raised to help Haiti in the aftermath of the 2020 earthquake. In the end, most of the money was squandered on administrative excesses, and the Red Cross built just six homes in Haiti. She'll be talking to us about her investigation and where people should not be directing funds today after this latest earthquake. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. So as the forever war has come to an end, it's time to accept that it's the end of American preeminence, too. Would it be in our nation's interest to use the 20th anniversary of 9/11 to reorient our place in the world? Is it time to prioritize not the threats that could be fomenting in a terrorist cell in some foreign land, but the threats that are at our front door, from the wildfires and floods brought on by climate change to the attacks on our own democratic processes? Andrew Basevich thinks it is. He's president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and a professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. His new book is After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. Andrew Basevich, welcome. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for being here, Andrew Basevich. I'm going to try not to be too much of a groupie because I'm a big fan of your writing and your TV.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, let's start with the piece you published a few days ago on the Washington Post about the age of American privilege is over, your argument that the formula for maintaining that global privilege no longer works. So what were you talking about?
Well, I was talking about the conditions that existed in the immediate aftermath of World War II. which was the moment when Americans discovered that they occupied the top of the hill. And George Kennan, the famous diplomat at the time serving in the State Department, wrote a paper that said, hey, look, the essence of that superiority is the amount of wealth controlled by the United States, by Americans, relative to the rest of the world. And in 1948, 1949, we controlled the great most of the wealth. And Kennan said, hey, look, the object of the exercise going forward, the central purpose of U.S. policy is to maintain this disparity, maintain this advantage. And my argument in the short piece is that defined the purpose of U.S. national security policy at the beginning of the Cold War and really through the Cold War, that we created institutions that were intended to enable us to project American hard power in order to maintain this disparity. How do we do that? Well, the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, the NATO, the creation of the CIA, the creation of the Strategic Air Command, this massive nuclear strike force. And it worked relatively well. That is to say, the Cold War was a period of American preeminence that we, not all of us, mostly us white people, I suppose, enjoyed great advantages. But I argue that age is gone. The age of American privilege has ended. Therefore, we need to think differently about our role in the world, and we need to reexamine this predisposition to project hard power as a way of advancing our interests.
Well, you also argue that the interests are not necessarily out there. The dangers, rather, the threats to us are not necessarily out there anymore. They're more here.
Precisely. In other words, we fell into the habit of thinking that if we could address the problems out there in Europe, in East Asia, in the Persian Gulf, that would be an approach that would sustain our well-being. And that's clearly no longer the case. I mean, every time we open the Boston Globe in the morning, and it's, the latest update on COVID, the latest update on the fires out in the Pacific Northwest, the latest update on floods, whether in Louisiana or much closer to home. So clearly the things that threaten us, that endanger our freedom, are much closer to home. And what that says is, therefore, there needs to be a radical redefinition of what national security means and what national security requires.
You know, Andrew Bacevich, I was just about to ask you again, as I asked you on television the other night, why is it that we never learn lessons from our foreign engagements, particularly the lesson that you just described to Marjorie? But before I asked that, I said to myself, Joe Biden has essentially put that lesson into place with his withdrawal from Afghanistan and his focus on exactly the things that you're talking about. Has he not?
I think it's too soon to tell exactly how Biden's approach to national security is going to play out. We also have to note that his own freedom of movement in that regard may be fairly limited. But I think your point is correct. He recognized the futility of the Afghanistan war. I think by extension, he recognized the futility of the so-called global war on terrorism. Certainly, at least in rhetoric, he places greater emphasis on these threats where we live that I think deserve more attention. But, we still got a Pentagon that spends somewhere in the vicinity of $900 billion or $1 trillion a year. We still have something like 750 bases scattered in dozens of countries around the world. So the posture that originated in the aftermath of World War II, it really still exists, the structure. So if there's going to be change along the lines that we are referring to, I think Biden has a long way to go.
You know, we're talking to Andrew Bacevich. His new book is After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. Before we get back to Afghanistan, I wonder if you thought about why it is that it is so much easier for us to focus sometimes hysterically on terrorists coming from elsewhere or, invaders coming here, as opposed to the things that are right in front of us, like, as you just mentioned, the terrible flooding, the terrible fires, et cetera. Why is it easier for so many of us, do you think?
I think it's because of the way we've come to define the phrase national security. That national security means things that are out there. National security means things that require a military response, not necessarily using force, but being prepared to use force. So if we had a radically different conception of national security, one that was more inclusive, you know, that included disease, that included the environment, then I think it would be easier for us to envision a reallocation of effort and resources where we'd say, well, maybe it makes sense for us to provide a little less money to the Pentagon and a little more money to other agencies that have a responsibility for these threats that occur where we live. But it's a mindset, I think, a mindset of national security that has evolved over decades, and it's going to take us a while to shake loose from that.
I want to talk about that mindset for a minute, Andrew Bacevich. I think it's I'm right when I say that a mindset that you would accept or embrace was the one that caused us to go into Afghanistan to begin with, to get rid of, we hoped, unsuccessfully, as it turned out, the organization that was the Taliban, that was harboring Osama bin Laden and the terrorists. That mindset is okay. It's the nation building of the last, I don't know, 15 years that I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're referring to. What is it in the American psyche that convinces us, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that we have an ability to create nations in our own image, or at least the image that we have of ourselves, even if it isn't reflected in reality anymore? How does that continue to exist?
Because we know others are supposed to be like us, right? I mean, isn't that reflect history's purpose and intention? Of course we think that. I mean, you're right. You know, it seems bizarre, but I do think that there is an expectation that humankind should follow a path that will bring it more or less to where we are or to where we are headed. And I think this notion is hardwired into our collective psyche. And it's, of course, it's continually reinforced by people who shape opinion. And by presidents, you know, who proclaim our unique historical role, despite evidence to the contrary. So, you know, it would require a sort of a radical change in our sense of where we fit in the larger trajectory of history to get over that.
We're talking to Andrew Bacevich from Boston University. You know, another piece you wrote was asking who should be held responsible. You lost your son, First Lieutenant Andrew Bacevich, who served in Iraq. He was killed in action there. And you asked who should you hold responsible, or whom should you hold responsible, I guess I should say. And you came to the conclusion, the American people. And I wonder why, because you just mentioned that we are told things by generals, we're told things by presidents that may not necessarily be true. I mean, so are Americans who... Why are the American people responsible, I guess is my question.
Well, because we claim to be a democracy. I mean, we claim to be a nation where those who make decisions in Washington are reflecting, expressing the will of the people. I mean, this has been set aside the question of my son. This has been something that has nagged at me for a long, long time. And that is the way that the American people are so disengaged from these wars of ours. So we have just concluded a 20-year-long war that ended with the enemy completely victorious. Now, you would think that there's been a lot of fuss about how messed up the evacuation was. But I think that that is actually far less important than the question of how we can fight a war for 20 years and then lose and then basically turn the page. I mean, there should be deep reflection on how this war went so badly. And it should be reflection that we, the people, are engaged in, participate in. It's not simply a question for military and political elites to sort out. The nation has failed in Afghanistan, and the nation ought to be interested in how that happened. So it's in that sense, I think that that there is a collective responsibility for the failures of U.S. policy, and we as citizens own a piece of that responsibility.
You know, we touched on this the other night, too. I have to say I'm with Marjorie. I mean, in the abstract, of course, Andrew Basevich, which I agree with you, but I think part of the mentality is in this country, as long as somebody else's son and daughter does the fighting and the sacrificing, then I can continue to go shopping.
I agree 1,000%. Okay. So, that's the problem of the all-volunteer force.
Man, and what was the name of the congressman from Harlem who every single cycle, even though he knew it had no chance of passing, would file a bill to reinstate the draft, not because he wanted there to be a draft, but because of the point you're making and I'm making that there's not shared sacrifice. Having said that, I want to get back to the point that Marjorie raised that I raised with you the other night. When you say it's the will of the people, it's not an informed will of the people. We spoke yesterday, I'm going to have him on television tonight, Michael Kirk, who just the brilliant filmmaker from Frontline, who did America After, is it called America After 9/11? I think that's what the newest is. And we're reminded of, when it comes to Iraq, the lying of Rumsfeld and Cheney, and the amen chorus, as Michael calls it, of the media, including the New York Times. The Afghanistan papers out of the Washington Post bore out that presidents, Democrats and Republicans, lied to us repeatedly about how we're being done in Afghanistan. So how are we, the people, supposed to express our will in an informed fashion when our leaders relentlessly lie to us about what we're achieving?
I mean, I'll be a little sarcastic, but, you know, we can spend a little less time on Facebook and Twitter.
Amen.
But I guess more seriously, the question gets to the absence of significant diversity of opinion within the ranks of the American elite. Yeah. Let's focus on national security. There is a powerful consensus to which Republicans and Democrats subscribe, in my opinion. Certainly, it's a consensus that the national security apparatus, like the military, subscribes, that says there is no alternative to American global leadership, with American global leadership expressed at least in part in military terms. There's no alternative. If you don't believe in that version of American global leadership, then you must be an isolationist. You must be an appeaser. So there is no serious debate, it seems to me, that would both allow for a fundamental critique of U.S. policy and also then consider alternatives to basic U.S. policy. And again, I mean, we'll wait and see how President Biden moves down this path. But, you know, his administration appears to be really gung-ho on putting the wars in the Middle East behind us and embracing the notion of great power competition, which is code for let's get it on with the Chinese. Yeah. And you know, down that path leads a Cold War or something worse, which I think would be potentially disastrous to us. So there, in a sense, there really is no debate about basic national security policy.
But you know that the overall theme I think you're getting to is when you think about it for 5 minutes or even 1 minute makes so much sense. We see all these guys, as you point out, the people that the generals are on TV. They have, you almost think, how can they stand up in their jackets because they got so many ribbons and awards on their lapels. You know, you think, wow, it must weigh 10 pounds, and you call for more modesty from some of these generals. But when you think about your life going forward, that in the United States of America right now, things have become so expensive. People are worried about if they should have children. They can't afford to get child care. They can't afford to buy a house. They can't afford the student debt. You know, we're debating now in Boston how much we're going to have to spend so we don't get the entire city isn't underwater in 20 years or 50 years, whatever it is, from climate change. You see what's going on in the West. It's like we don't address any of the things that are so dramatically impacting our lives right now. And yet we hear all the time on television or in the news, well, you know, we're getting behind in this war race. We're getting behind, and we're not spending enough money on the Pentagon. And then you read about the excesses at the Pentagon. So it's kind of like it's all there, I think, but we don't seem to embrace it. You know,
if I can give you a 15-second commercial for the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft,
please do.
I mean, we are a startup think tank. I'm talking to you from Walpole, Massachusetts. My colleagues are in Washington. We are trying to promote an appreciation for restraint as a principle of U.S. foreign policy. That's not isolationism. It's not disarmament. It's being more prudent with regard to the use of force, more prudent with regard to the expectations of what force can do, more creative when engaging the rest of the world to try to solve the problems, which are some of which you've just ticked off. So, it's hard to break through the consensus on national security, which has developed over the past 60 or so years.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to ask you about, we're talking with Andrew Bacevich. His new book is After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed, and he's president, if we just mentioned, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. This is another thing that we in the media do all the time when you get, especially on television, after this horrible tragedy in Afghanistan, ask, well, what did these men and women give their lives for? And you talk about how they died for their country. They were ordinary soldiers. They followed the orders. They weren't making the decisions. But, you know, I've thought about how few people actually sign up. When you think about these men and women, whether they join the Marines or the Army or the National Guard, they're saying, they're standing up. They're saying, I am willing to serve. I hope it doesn't happen, but I am willing to die for my country. And it seems to me just the bravery and the self-sacrifice, I mean, I don't know if that's what they died for, but it's certainly what they should be commended for, because almost none of us do it. I wouldn't want my son, to be honest, to join the military. I'd be too afraid.
Marjorie, none of us provide service to our country even without putting our lives at risk,
But I guess what I'm kind of asking is these are the people, what is it, how many of us serve in the military? 1% or something like that?
About that.
Yeah. So, they're a hero the moment they sign up.
Yeah, well, I think what you're touching on is a great need. Many other people have said this, it never goes anywhere, that there's a need for us to have a serious conversation on citizenship.
Yeah.
Citizenship provides for rights, freedoms, guarantees my freedoms. But citizenship also arguably should entail obligations. Yeah, pay taxes. Obligations beyond that? Well, then what are they? And I think that, we talk a lot about the greatest generation, the generation of my parents, both of whom served during World War II, shouldn't be romanticized, but there does seem to have been a broader appreciation that if I'm a citizen, I owe something
right
to the country. And I can't cite polling data or anything, but it just seems to me that no longer exists. Yes, there are those who volunteer, just as there are people who volunteer to you know, join the Peace Corps. Not that there's an absence of virtue in our country. You think about the medical people who have served so valiantly during the pandemic. There are good people who do good things, but somehow collectively, it seems to me, maybe I'm way off base here, that collectively we've lost any sense of citizenship entailing obligation. And I think that's a loss.
You know, before you go, this is one of my sort of favorite themes on which I get virtually nowhere. I am a huge believer that there should be a mandatory obligation of citizenship, which specifically would be mandatory non-military service. For example, if you want to serve in the military, it's fine. But if you don't want to serve in the military, then serve your neighbors in some other capacity. And I think the argument for that, Andrew Bacevich, is even stronger with the divisions we have in this country, where people are so isolated from other people who are not like them that they don't even experience the world beyond their borders, their gates, that sort of thing. What do you think of that notion of the notion of every 18-year-old in this country providing a year of his or her life to serve their country?
I'm totally for it. Of course, I'm not 18 anymore. And that's part of the problem, I think. You know, it's us senior citizens who say, hey, I got a great idea. Let's have everybody be signed up for 2 years of involuntary service. But it is a good idea. And it gets talked about a lot. Why doesn't it sort of catch on? I think because there's some institutional interests that oppose it. You know, the generals don't want to have an army of conscripts by whatever under whatever auspices. Their life is easier when they have this professional force that we send off to fight wars for 20 years. I think, you know, again, the people would have to say, that's what we want to be. We want civic obligation to be central to the way our country runs. But if the people don't say that, it ain't going to happen.
You know, one more thing from me, Andrew Bacevich, since you are a history professor, I sometimes get despondent, thinking that this is it. We're on the downhill slide here. We can't fix the roads. We can't fix the schools. We can't fix healthcare. On and on and on and on. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about where the United States of America is heading?
Well, in that book of mine that you kindly referred to, I admit to being pessimistic. I didn't write that book for our generation, for my generation. But I do think one has to hope that the next generation will do better. So I cling to optimism in that regard, that my granddaughter, my grandsons, as they reach adulthood, that they'll be smarter than my generation was, and perhaps they'll redeem the country.
Andrew Bacevich, thank you much for your thoughts. We really appreciate your time, as always.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich is president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's also a professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. And his new book, which we should all go out and read, is After the Apocalypse, America's Role in a World Transformed. Thanks so much to Andrew Bacevich for being with us. Coming up, Representative Mike Conley joins us to talk about his legislative push to reverse the state's happy hour ban. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. Massachusetts banned happy hour in 1984 after the drunk driving death of a 20-year-old Kathleen Barry. Before the fatal car accident, Barry met friends for happy hour at the Ground Round in Braintree. Nearly 40 years later, there's a push on Beacon Hill to bring back happy hour. Is it time? State Representative Mike Conley has just filed a bill that we revisit the state's ban. He sees it as one way to help the restaurants and bars that have been hard hit by the pandemic, and he joins us on the line to talk about the effort. Mike Conley, welcome back to the show. Good to talk to you.
Good afternoon, Jim. Good afternoon, Marjorie.
Hey there.
Thank you very much, Representative, for joining us. So what are you proposing?
So we've filed the final text of a bill early this week that would it's a comprehensive bill to help restaurants and bars. It would start by making permanent some of those popular measures that emerged from the pandemic, like to-go cocktails, outdoor dining, and caps on third-party delivery fees. And this is the part that's been getting a lot of attention over the summer as we've worked on it. It would create a commission to bring stakeholders together to see if we can find consensus on ways to revisit the state's ban on happy hour in a responsible fashion.
You know, I used to spend some time on Beacon Hill, not as an elected official like you, but as a lobbyist, and I use the term loosely. Commissions are usually where good ideas go to die. Why, if you think this is the right move, why didn't you, Representative, just do the research, group together a bunch of colleagues who support your notion, and my understanding from polling is the public overwhelmingly supports your notion, and just do it?
You know, it's a good question, but from my vantage point, you know, I think there is a lot of nuance to the issue. There's a lot of diversity among restaurants and bars in different sectors of the hospitality industry. And, you know, we've seen examples where the legislature hasn't been proactive. I'm thinking about the marijuana legalization effort. Where the legislature sort of sits back and lets others do their work for them, and then they throw the brakes on it and do all the work afterwards, which can be very frustrating for everyone involved. And you know, I'll also just add for the record, and I was listening to a little bit of the show earlier, I do want to make the point that, you know, this is not the most important issue facing the Commonwealth, you know, as we look ahead to the fall. I'm hoping we'll extend the eviction moratorium, pass the Votes Act, continue working to address climate change and systemic racism, and try to bring this pandemic to an end and try to mitigate the loss of life. But really, my interest in this topic emerged from the pandemic. I often found myself in a position of criticizing Governor Baker, of advocating for stronger public health restrictions. And I feel there's a duty along with those efforts to also look to help those who are impacted. And we know our restaurants and bars have been terribly impacted. So this is really an effort to advance the conversation and see if we can find a way to deliver additional relief.
Well, you know, one of the things that doesn't get mentioned enough in some of these stories, it seems to me, Representative Conley, is that the laws, the penalties for drunk driving are a lot more serious in 2021 than they were way back when these laws against the happy hours came around in the 80s. I mean, we all remember Ron Bersani, whose granddaughter was killed by a drunk driver, and he went door to door over the legislature to help strengthen those laws. It's a different legal situation now than it was then, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the culture has definitely changed for the better. You know, one of the things that we've done intentionally as we've crafted the outline for this commission is we've wanted Mothers Against Drunk Driving to be right there at the table,
yep,
having a voice in this conversation. And, you know, I'd also note Illinois and Kansas had bans on happy hour. More recently, they did away with their bans. And it's been reported that neither saw a meaningful uptick in drunk driving fatalities. So I think there's a lot to discuss as we look at this.
You know, by the way, and not just have the laws changed, but also the point's been made repeatedly in this happy hour debate. We didn't have Lyft and Uber and those sort of things, obviously, in 1984 when Governor Dukakis led the charge here.
But we also don't have people joking about how they were too drunk last night
point.
To drive. I mean, the attitudes.
You're right.
When I was a kid, it was kind of a joke to say, I had six beers and I could barely drive home.
Right.
Now you're looked at as a bad person if you do those kinds of things. The attitudes and the tolerance of drunk driving, I think, has done a 180. But I'm sorry, Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, am I not right? When you were describing the legislature and the marijuana laws, were the legislature's behavior, both by not dealing with the issue, was humiliating, in my opinion. And even more humiliating was when they attempted repeatedly to thwart the popular will by causing there to be years of lapse between the voters speaking and implementation, for example, recreational. By the way, that happened on three ballot questions, three ballot questions relating to marijuana. But isn't that potentially about to happen again? Am I not right, Representative? Is there not a proposed ballot question which would reinstitute happy hour if the legislature doesn't act?
That is correct. A Dorchester attorney, Nicholas Silveira, filed a ballot question. I believe it was just recently certified by the AG's office. So now it'll be a matter of collecting signatures. But certainly, I think that is part of the intent here, is we should have that public conversation in a robust way. When it comes to a ballot question, it's just yes or no on every single detail. And I think we could get the details right if we engage in more of a conversation.
You know, you mentioned Mothers Against Drunk Driving a minute ago, and you're not the only one who referenced them. Somebody else referenced them. That was the governor. Here is Governor Baker when he was asked about this renewed push to bring back happy hour to Massachusetts not too long ago.
I remember what was going on the roads in Massachusetts when we had happy hours. And there were some awful, horrible, terrible experiences on a very regular basis that came with happy hours back in the day. And I know that probably makes me a stick in the mud to say such a thing, but I would start as a skeptic of going back to the way we ran happy hours once upon a time. And I know the folks at Mothers Against Drunk Driving would be with me on that one.
But correct me if I'm wrong, Representative, Mothers Against Drunk Driving are not with him on that one, are they? My understanding is they're taking no position on this. I believe what they say is we're obviously opposed to driving while drinking, but they're agnostic on this? Or what is MAD's position on this?
So, you know, I did have the opportunity to meet with MAD a few weeks ago, and, you know, we discussed the issue. And, yeah, what they conveyed to me is that they are not taking a stance either way on the issue. And again, just to reiterate, you know, I think their voice in the conversation would be very important.
You know, when you're talking about helping restaurants, Marjorie and I have spent a huge amount of time in the last 18 months talking about small independent businesses and restaurants in particular, small independent restaurants, and how they've survived, which have survived this pandemic. And I'm thinking about an editorial in the Globe the other day about same-day voting registration and how the editorialist, the person whoever wrote it, referred to it, the pace with which the legislature acts as being glacial. And, you know, when restaurants are about to potentially have to live through yet another year of a lot of people being nervous about going back inside to eat, you're part of this bill, if I read it correctly, would extend the provision, I think virtually all of which have expired, the 15% cap on these usurious delivery fees by the Uber Eats and the DoorDashes, that sort of stuff, takeout drinks, outside dining. In light of the fact that so many of these restaurants are hanging by a thread, let me ask an incredibly naive question. Why is there not just action on this tomorrow? Who's other than the package stores, for example, who were allowed to stay open through the whole damn pandemic. So I would argue they don't have much of a basis to criticize takeout drinks from restaurants. Who opposes any of these things? And why aren't they just made law so that restaurateurs know what the rules of the road are come the fall?
You know, it's an excellent question. And to be fair, we have taken some action in the legislature on some of these items. You know, Governor Baker allowed the state of emergency to expire back in June. We in the legislature did a temporary extension on the outdoor dining provisions. So they have now been extended until April of next year. We also did an extension on cocktails to go back in June. That's been extended until March, both of which are hugely popular. And so I think part of this bill is advancing that conversation around let's do this on a permanent basis. To your point, you know, there are some incredible lobbying efforts by those big third-party delivery apps, which completely are ripping off our constituents and ripping off the restaurants in many cases. So those have expired. And so there is, I think, great urgency on addressing the caps on delivery fees. And then, you know, one other point, you know, we had this federal restaurant relief bill.
Yeah.
And, you know, it had great intentions, but I'm afraid it fell short on its promises. You know, roughly 70% of restaurants received no funding at all. This fall on Beacon Hill, we are planning to debate how to spend $5.3 billion in federal ARPA money. And so I'm hoping that, you know, as we have that debate, we also look to help these businesses that did exactly the right thing. You know, many of them closed down completely, you know, for the sake of their staff and for public health. And so particularly those smallest businesses, we have to throw them a lifeline and ensure that they survive.
I want to focus on one piece of this that that Marjorie knows. I've been in favor of this for decades, long before a pandemic.
That's
this
right.
Outdoor dining
a man
thing.
Ahead of his time.
No, I mean, this outdoor dining thing is one of the great things that has ever happened anywhere in the world, and particularly wonderful in the streets of Boston. Who is opposed to this other than, I don't know, parking meter attendants? I mean, in all seriousness, who opposes restaurants being permanently able, as long as they're not blocking streets, from allowing people to eat outside? Is that what it is?
You know, I mean, I think there's strong support. You know, the Mass Inc. poll that polled several of these issues earlier this summer showed 72% support for continuing outdoor dining. So maybe there are some curmudgeons out there, but you know, it's been a huge hit, you know, here in Cambridge and in Somerville and really across the state. So I hope we continue it.
You know, one last unrelated thing, but I know it's something you care deeply about. Could you just describe to people what the current state of protection around evictions is for people? Again, I know we've talked about this in the past. I know it's something you've spent a lot of time. What protections continue to exist for people in Massachusetts?
So thank you for that. And, you know, it's such an important issue, particularly as the Delta variant continues to cause concern. The biggest protection we have right now are tenants who are facing eviction to the extent they have an application for rental assistance pending. Courts cannot proceed with their eviction cases. However, you know, there are large gaps in that one layer of protection. For example, landlords aren't obligated to accept the rental assistance. So you may do everything right and qualify. And at the end of the day, a landlord could say, I want to push that tenant out anyways. And so there's a bill on Beacon Hill called the COVID-19 Housing Equity Bill that I've been working on. And I'm certainly hoping we'll take action on it. You know, we're in a position where the Biden administration is standing, you know, at the podium, the press secretary saying, I'm calling on states, I'm calling on cities to pass their own eviction moratoria. There's no reason why here in Massachusetts, with a supermajority of Democrats, we can't answer the call from the Biden administration and do even more.
You know, before you leave, though, I just want you to explain one thing to me, Representative Connolly. When you say the landlord has the right to refuse the rental assistance, is that if an eviction is for cause other than non-payment, or is it even in non-payment cases?
I believe even in non-payment cases.
What's the rationale for that? If the only issue is you haven't paid and you're willing to pay, what business is it of the landlords what the source of the money is?
You know, that I think that's why we want to go further. It's a very thin layer of protection that we have in place. It would forestall an eviction, but it requires cooperation on both sides. And, you know, I think when it comes to vulnerable tenants in particular, what we ought to do, I mentioned the $5.3 billion earlier, mm-hmm. Our starting point should be we're going to ban evictions for COVID-impacted tenants, and then say to landlords, we have this hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars exactly. of rental assistance available. You are invited to engage in the process, and we will work to make you whole. And so the burden shouldn't be placed on the vulnerable tenant who's been impacted by COVID. We should flip the equation and protect the tenant first and then distribute the money as quickly as possible.
Well, you have my vote, which counts for nothing on that. Representative.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. State Representative Mike Conley has, of course, as we've just been discussing, filed a bill to revisit Massachusetts' happy hour ban. And we thank him again. Coming up, when it comes to giving aid to Haiti, is it best to avoid the Red Cross with its red tape? That conversation is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. The latest earthquake in Haiti is rekindling the anger and frustration locals experience in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake. Of the billions of dollars in foreign aid that was coming in, little reached the people who needed it most. This time around, activists are urging the public to donate money to local organizations and groups rather than give to large, disconnected organizations. In 2015, NPR's Laura Sullivan, in concert with ProPublica, reported extensively on the Red Cross. The charity raised almost $500 million for Haiti in the aftermath of the 2010 quake. It was one of the most successful fundraising efforts ever for them, but it didn't turn out to be a success story for Haiti. Laura Sullivan, welcome back to Boston Public Radio. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us, Laura. So many people are want to try to help Haiti. We've had a lot of local efforts here sending supplies. But it's clear from your reporting, if we want to help, we shouldn't send our money to the Red Cross. So tell people why to cross them off the list.
So there's been, you know, when we actually looked into the $500 million that the Red Cross raised for the 2010 earthquake, you know, they said that they were going to build tens of thousands of homes, and they claimed that they had built 130,000 permanent homes. When we got down to Haiti, we actually found that they had built six permanent homes. And the reason, you know, there was a lot of sort of over exaggerating that was happening. There was a lot of mismanagement of projects that was happening. And what they were doing was kind of, they would go out into a community, maybe show some people how to use a hammer, and they would sort of say, we had helped that person, you know, give them a permanent home of some kind. They counted that. So there was a lot of this kind of number manipulation that was happening. But we also found sort of greater problems in just how they were saying they were spending the money. When we actually got a hold of the amount of money that they were raising and what and where it actually went, which was very hard to do, by the way. They're not particularly transparent about this. We found that an extraordinary amount was going to administrative expenses. They raised $500 million, and they basically spent $125 million on themselves. So that means $125 million just never even left the United States. It was just spent on the Red Cross itself. And then the bigger problem was that for the rest of the money that they raised, they were just farming it out to other charities. And those charities then took their own cuts of the money. So they would take their, you know, administrative expenses on top of that. So that was another 10 or 12% administrative expenses before the money even got to the ground in Haiti. So, at, you know, at one point, and then those charities would then farm it out to another charity. So at some point, you know, a donor would give a dollar and 30 cents made it to the ground in Haiti. So
can we go back to the first number for a second? When I read this thing, and by the way, we're talking to Laura Sullivan, not about the Trump Foundation. We're talking about the Red Cross in this instance. They contend that they built 130,000 houses in Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. And your reporting suggests that they built six, as in the number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, six?
Six.
And yeah, what six. Are they, what do they say about that?
Well, it took months to get this number out of them. I think this is one of the problems that our investigation found with the Red Cross, is that they give you these giant blanket numbers. You know, we built 130,000 homes, and we went back and forth and back and forth with them saying, where are these homes? Mm-hmm. Where do we find them? And at the end of the day, they could only point to six homes that they had built. They got in way over their head. They didn't know how to build communities. They didn't know how to spend this money. And, you know, it wasn't because it couldn't be done. We found other charities that were building homes in mm-hmm. Haiti. It's just that the Red Cross had a number of significant problems that was preventing them from doing it. And they, you know, they just couldn't seem to wield this massive amount of money that they had in any effective way.
Well, Laura, one of the things you talk about that might have caused them some problems, I guess a lot of them were pretty insulting to the Haitians that were there, while the people that were coming from the United States were living in nice quarters and doing quite well salary-wise. So why attack the people that you might want to help you?
Right. We saw a number of problems and complaints in their own internal reports that were talking about not only their sort of problem with just, you know, mismanagement of the problem of the project, but mismanagement of their personnel. They were not hiring local was one of the biggest complaints that these internal documents showed. They were, you know, which is a problem twofold. One, because it's very expensive to bring in people from the United States or from other countries to come into Haiti to live, and you have to pay their housing, their travel, and all of their expenses. But on top of that, they don't know the country the way right. local Haitians do. They don't have those networks into the communities. They don't have that trust built where you're going to come in and say, we're going to build these homes and communities and schools for you. So they were hamstrung from the beginning. And, you know, we would go out to these neighborhoods and people were devastated. The Red Cross had come in. They said, we're going to spend $20 or $30 million in this one particular community. They put a giant Red Cross, you know, did a paint job on the, you know, the soccer area, and, you know, American, you know, Red Cross, here we come. And at the end of the day, they never built what they had promised. Years had gone by when we showed up there, and nobody had any idea where the Red Cross had gone. And, you know, they were asking us when we arrived, do you know anybody at the Red Cross that you could call? You know, they wanted us to call the Red Cross and ask them where they went.
You know, Laura, when you mentioned, we're talking to Laura Sullivan from NPR, did this great reporting in 2015 with ProPublica about what Red Cross did and didn't do with $500 million it raised purportedly to help people in Haiti. When you mentioned, I think it was $125 million or whatever it was for administrative costs, to be clear, those weren't even administrative costs purely related to their work in Haiti. If it had been related, I assume one can argue it's excessive, but it's relevant. Didn't they pay down their overall deficit with part of the money that people contributed to help Haiti?
That's right. And, you know, they have this statement where they say, you know, less than, you know, less than 10% of every dollar spent goes to administrative fees. And after we finally got the actual financial records from the Red Cross, which took months, we actually saw that what they were doing is they were using this other category called program expenses that they would then, you know, end up spending about 25% of the money on their own internal administrative expenses, whether that be debt or salaries or things for people in the United States, not for anything related to people working in Haiti. And it took them, they had a really difficult time acknowledging that this was happening. And even when Congress and asked them to, you know, release these records and show where the money spent, they still, you know, were sort of refusing. And to this day, do not outline where, you know, how each dollar spent specifically.
You know, Go ahead, Marjorie.
Glad you mentioned Congress, because didn't Congress, Grassley, the senator from
Grassley,
Iowa,
yeah.
Didn't mm-hmm. he hold hearings on this? Is this what you're referring to?
So he did, and his staff and a number of other people in Congress did, you know, push the Red Cross to really sort of release records and hold them accountable, and said, and did a report saying, you know, you don't have enough oversight for where your money's going. You aren't being upfront enough about this. You don't have an internal watchdog organization. It's been cut down to just a couple people. And, you know, over the years, the Red Cross says that they have done a lot to change and to try to be more transparent, but the criticisms still remain, and there's still a lot of frustration that the Red Cross often gets a free pass in a way that other organizations don't.
Laura Solomon, it seems to me that every time we speak to you, about halfway through the interview, I ask you the exact same question, which is, how is this not a crime? And you know, as it relates to this, they are telling the people of this country, I assume most of these $500 million in donations came from the United States, or whatever percentage, you're donating to Haiti. They don't say you're donating to reduce or eliminate our deficit or to pay our administrative costs. They're not transparent. I mean, I know that different states oversee charities in different ways. We've discussed it with the Massachusetts Attorney General, her authority, lots of times. Why isn't this a crime if you raise money under false pretenses and spend it on purposes not those which are represented to the donors? You know what I mean?
Yeah. The Red Cross would say that it is being transparent and that it is being honest about how it's being spent. The difference is they're just being vague. That's the problem we found, is that they would say, well, we spent hundreds of millions in Haiti, but they wouldn't be specific. They wouldn't show us what project cost what, how much money did you spend here? What did you do here? And that's a transparency that has always been lacking. And I think, you know, the Red Cross is one of the country's most, you know, respected organizations that has been around for decades and decades and has served so much good. And they have been able to ride on the coattails of that goodwill. It is a very unique organization because it is it has this sort of government component to it, with its board. The President of the United States is part of the American Red Cross, and the country depends on it.
But it's not, if I may, we're treating this, and correct me if I'm wrong, is as if this is aberrational. I believe I recall, didn't Elliot Spitzer, before he was the disgraced former elected official in New York, when he was Attorney General, didn't they raise another $500 million after 9/11, and only somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 million ever got to the purposes?
Three scandals, right? There was the 9/11 scandal you report on, the Katrina scandal, and the Hurricane Sandy scandal. There were three.
I didn't even know about the Sandy. But this is not that abnormal for this longstanding, respected organization, right?
Yeah. And it even goes back to the Loma Prieta earthquake in California in 1989, I believe. And there was a lot of complaints that the American Red Cross had raised all this money to build housing for earthquake victims. And one of the cities ended up suing the American Red Cross and saying, you never gave us the money you said you were going to give us. So this is a long standing problem. There is not enough oversight or transparency when it comes to the Red Cross, which is why a lot of people are now saying you should donate locally into Haiti. And there's organizations like Haiti.com or other places on the web where you can see local Haitian charities that and what they're doing and where your money's going. And you lose a little bit in oversight, but you do know that at least your entire dollar made it to Haiti.
We're talking with Laura Sullivan from NPR, who's done great reporting on the scandals at the Red Cross. You know, you mentioned, I think, in one of these stories I read, Laura, that despite what happened back in California in the late 80s, Katrina, Sandy, 9/11, et cetera, that the Red Cross remains the number one charity of choice. And when people want to give money, they give to them.
It's easy. Everybody knows it. And a lot of people have personal experiences with the Red Cross because it is an organization. At its best, it is volunteers. It is right. Tens of thousands of American volunteers who get out there and get in their own cars during a crisis and help other Americans. And there is that is truly where the Red Cross is at its. You know, it is, nothing can compete with that. And I think because people have that personal experience, maybe they had a fire, or maybe they know a relative who had a flood and the Red Cross was there, they have this sense of goodwill toward the Red Cross. But what they have is a sense of goodwill toward the U.S. American Red Cross volunteer who showed up with the vest on at their door to help them in that moment of crisis.
Don't forget, Laura.
Yeah.
Don't you remember reading those little biographies when you were a kid? You know, and one of them was Clara Barton, right? Who started the Red Cross. We all read about her in third grade or something like that. But what's the story with the woman who's a director, Red Cross director Gail McGovern? You report on how, you know, you asked her to document the work and she wouldn't do it. So what's her deal? Mm-hmm. She must know that this is not correct.
It's hard. I mean, she has been the leader of the Red Cross for years now. She says she has made great changes to the organization. She feels that she has streamlined it. She feels that the organization has been responsive to Congress, and she thinks they're doing a great job.
You know, can we stay on Congress just for 1 second, Laura Sullivan? So Senator Grassley holds these hearings, basically confirms your reporting, and then some. For example, one other piece we haven't mentioned is that Senator Grassley said that the representation was made by McGovern and the Red Cross that they had spent $70 million of the $500 million on oversight. And I believe the quote from the committee counsel or someone there was there was, quote, no evidence of any expenditures on oversight. Were there any recommendations out of his committee as to requirements of greater transparency, greater reporting, something, greater oversight in terms of all major charitable enterprises in this country, or was it just a report and then move on?
Yeah, they absolutely said that the Red Cross needed to step up, needed to be more transparent, needed to drop this very kind of almost secret category of program expenses mm-hmm. when it was calculating how the money spent, and said that it needed to do a better job overseeing the other charities that it was then hiring to do projects. Grassley's report, and the report found that some of these projects had no oversight at all. And we certainly saw that as well on the ground. The Red Cross has been incredibly reticent to make any changes, and Congress has not held them to account to this day to make the changes that were recommended. The kind of thing that we saw was that, you know, they would say that they had spent tens of millions of dollars on a health program. And it turned out that they were actually handing out, they would go to a community and put out a lot of pamphlets on how to wash your hands. Mm-hmm. In one case, in a community that didn't even have running water.
Oh my God.
And they would say, well, we spent $50 million on a, health program kind of thing. So there was just not a lot of, not only was there no transparency, but there was no oversight into how this money was actually getting spent.
So, Laura Sullivan, you mentioned that we, and Laura's from NPR, you mentioned we should try to give to local charities, which is a great idea, but it is sometimes harder for people to find those things. I think there are some ones that are very well known, Doctors Without Borders, which I think is doing a pretty good job. You know, the Catholic Church has had terrible trouble with pedophile priests, as we all know. But a lot of us think of Catholic Relief Services as an international charity that's well-known and easy to give to and doing good work. I mean, I know your reporting was focused on the Red Cross, not on Doctors Without Borders or Catholic Relief, but I'm just wondering if there are international well-known charities that people can trust, or should we just go right to local ones, and if so, how to find them?
The folks, leadership in Haiti would prefer that the money be donated locally, where there's local people working and running these projects. So you just really have to kind of do your own sniff test about what are you looking at when you're looking at these glossy photos, when you're looking at the websites. Does it feel like they're making a lot of vague claims? Does it feel like they're saying we're going to help, you know, millions of people with $100 million? Or are they saying we built 92 homes in this neighborhood and now we need, you know, $102 million because we'd like to build, you know, 98 more? Or, you know, is it very specific what they're doing with this exact money? That's the kind of thing you're looking for. There are websites. There's Haiti.com, which Great. Outlines local charities. You can Great. See exactly sort of what they do. You can follow along where your money's getting spent. And you can ensure that the entire dollar at least is getting to the country. There's been a lot fewer people donating this earthquake around. They're really struggling. Less than half of the people have received any aid at all in Haiti. There's a lot of other things going on in the world right now. So, you know, this certainly Haiti is not receiving anywhere near the amount of money that it did the last time.
Well, Laura Sullivan, thank you for this great reporting exposing the Red Cross, and thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great talking to you guys.
You too.
Laura Sullivan is an investigative correspondent for National Public Radio. You can read her 2015 special report on the Red Cross at npr.org. And thanks again to Laura Sullivan. Coming up, move over Amazon. Harvard University is also expanding its land grab, and Boston Globe's Shirley Young joins us for that and more on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Bradley. Joining us online to go over the latest local business headlines, including what I think Marjorie described as a local land grab. I think that's what she described it as.
I meant to say land grab, of course, Jim.
There's a land grab in Allston. Is Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young. Shirley's also a GBH contributor. Shirley, good to talk to you.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey.
Hello, Shirley Young. Great to talk to you. So one of your colleagues, Janelle Nanos, wrote a great piece talking about how we all were all excited here, Boston, life getting back to normal, and then Delta turned everything around, and she focused in on the Back Bay. So what's up?
So a lot of us thought a lot of office workers would return to downtown after Labor Day, but then the Delta variant derailed a lot of those plans, and a lot of employers have delayed the return to office to October, November, some cases not till 2022. And what Janelle did was that she focused on the Back Bay, where, there's John Hancock is there and some other companies as well. And she talked to the small businesses that rely on office workers, like the dry cleaner right there and the restaurants in the neighborhood. I think there were restaurants and that were ready to, throw these welcome back to the neighborhood, welcome back to the office get-togethers. And a lot of those had to go back to virtual. it's just a story about kind of how COVID has really created all these fits and starts in the economy of really false starts, really. We thought that things were returned to normal in September, but it's not normal.
You know, when I was reading her story, and I was thinking back to the story you did, that it's got to be at least a year ago when you walked down Newbury Street and and saw sort of the trickle down impact of the same sort of high rises, the Hancocks, the Prues, whatever, being essentially employee free. I'm sure it's been done, and I'm sure you've talked to some of these people. It's one thing to have a business plan to get through yet another year of this nightmare in the winter. I don't know how small business people make it through yet another year of this, Shirley, when, you know, a lot of their colleagues, a lot of their competitors didn't make it through. They fought like hell, held their breath, did the best they can, and finally, as we were just saying, saw the proverbial light, and then it's snuffed out for them. I don't know how they do it.
I think that is the hardest part, Jim. I think, you know, at least last summer, you know, people were running on adrenaline. They had all this federal money flowing in, right, to help them. Mm. And now you just don't know where the end is, right? You have no idea. And then there's talk of a new variant taking hold where, you know, the vaccines might not work. And so this is a really difficult period right now because the money's dried up, right? The federal money's dried up, and people just don't know how to plan anymore, and they're exhausted from all the false starts.
So, speaking of business columnist Shirley Leung, and speaking of Boston and business, latest poll, the Globe poll, has in the mayoral race, which I guess is just, 6 days away? Is that what it is? Yeah, 6 days away, at least the preliminary, the runoff, has Michelle Wu with a pretty significant lead, Asabi George, Campbell, and Janie in a virtual dead heat for second, 10-plus points behind, and John Barrows trailing significantly. You write a piece about how business, which I guess was wary, for lack of a better expression, bigger businesses of the front runner, Michelle Wu, are warming to her. Is that because they've looked at the merits of her proposals and they're more comfortable, or because they want to be with who they believe is the likely, I'm not saying this is the case, but who they perceive to be the likely winner of this thing?
You know, the people I interviewed in the piece, they have been with Michelle Wu before, kind of her commanding.
The surge, I say, okay.
Yeah, the surge in the last, month. It's an interesting group of kind of executives, business leaders that I talk to. I start the story with Jack Connors, who is probably one of the most influential business leaders, right, in town. And I had been wondering for a long time, who's Jack supporting, right? And I had heard a few weeks ago that he was supporting Michelle Wu, and he wasn't really quite ready to talk yet. And then, you know, then people started telling me, Jack Connors is holding a fundraiser for Michelle Wu. And those invites went out before her surge in the polls. Mm. And so, he's been following her and her, her career. And so I think that's a huge statement. When I thought about the story, I was thinking, like, it's almost like he's sending a bat signal, you know, to the rest of the business community that, I'm with Michelle Wu. It's okay. Because Michelle has been she's been a longtime city councilor, and she has been really, she's been really tough on the business community, specifically the development community. Yeah. And so there was this impression out there that the business community was really scared of Michelle Wu, anyone but Michelle Wu. And I was struck by how there are business leaders who support her beyond Jack, David D'Alessandro, the former CEO of John Hancock. It was interesting. I was struck by how some of these kind of old time leaders, they didn't really know the candidates. But when the field, when it was clear to be an open race, they started just calling candidates and wanting to meet with them. And so D'Alessandro reached out to Wu last fall, curious about her wanting to run for mayor, and really kind of fell in line and thought that, she should be the next mayor of Boston. I mean, the quote from him was, she's a very, very progressive and Eno.
Yeah. By the way, I love the way you end this column. Every column that Shirley Leung writes on the mayor's race ends with exactly the same line, a variation on the same line. Is one thing's for sure, the race is a woman's to lose and a woman's to win,
yeah.
Shirley Leung.
But you know what's interesting when you hear what you talk about, you quote some people who are a little concerned about her development-wise. But I thought it was great when she went after Walsh on this corruption scandal at the Zoning Board of Appeals. Remember, the guy was getting – he went to jail, didn't he? The guy
for
taking,
bribes, for accepting bribes.
Yes. And, so, I mean, heaven knows. I think that there's a lot of people in Boston who are concerned about the way development goes down here. And so, you know, if you want to see more honest development, I mean, she's been tough on that issue, no question about it.
She has. And I think what's interesting that, you know, usually developers, they don't pick sides, right? They like to hedge their bets.
Right.
And it's interesting that some of the developers are, so they're some of the developers and real estate lawyers are really concerned about a Mayor Wu. And some of them have banded together, including prominent Boston developer Tom O'Brien, who's the former head of the Boston Redevelopment Authority. He is on, Mayor Janey's finance committee.
How about Mike Ross?
Mike Ross, exactly.
Well, now he's a real estate lawyer, Jim.
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah, Mike was great. I was like Mike Pitbull Ross. I mean, he was like kind of the, you know, I don't know if he's the Pitbull or the Pit Boss, but he came out, right? He was like now or never, because if you think about it, the you know, Michelle Wu is so far ahead, right? She's going to almost certainly she will make it into the finals, into the November. And it is a fight for number two. And Janey is right in there with Adrian Campbell and also Anissa George and Sabi George. And so, you know, he laid out the gauntlet and said, you know, another reason why, you know, I think Janey is good for development. I think we should be concerned about Michelle Wu when it comes to the business community. But he also said, you know, I think Janey is the only candidate that can beat Wu in November.
Well, you know what was interesting is the Globe, I think it was a Spotlight team, or maybe it was Andrea Estes. I'm not sure who did this great story. Somebody did this great story. Forgive me, I forget the byline. On Sabi George's husband and what was a really checkered record, all sorts of violations from the city, allegations of criminal complaints, really kind of sketchy. And yes. It seems not to have, maybe it has hurt her, but I don't know. Does that, I thought that was almost disqualifying, and yet she's still in the running.
Yeah, and her husband is a housing developer, and yeah, she's remained in the running. I mean, what was really interesting was when you, it was actually hard to find a kind of a prominent business leader supporting Sabi George, but it was interesting when you talk to them, you know, those who follow politics very closely, they thought that she had that she's going to probably make the finals. She's got a good base of supporters in the neighborhoods. She, like Michelle Wu, has run district-wide, citywide.
Right.
And so while the others, Janey and Campbell, are district counselors, and so both Wu and Sabi George have the base and may have the biggest number of votes come Tuesday.
Well, Sabi George is more moderate. I mean, I think she does not, correct me if I'm wrong, she's not been big on reforming the cops, right? So she probably gets support from them.
Right. And if you think that she's adopted this incredibly smart strategy in a progressive field, she's your smart, she's your moderate candidate.
You know, just when you were talking about Mike Ross, and we highlighted him because a lot of people listening know Mike from when he was a city councilor, ran for mayor as well. I didn't even know he was doing real estate lawyering. I don't think I knew anyway. And he is saying that Janey's the one. Isn't Janey, how does he feel about her after she, you wrote a piece about this, sort of finally joined the chorus and put the kibosh on the Don Chaffaro's replacement for the that Harbor Garage thing? Is he still feeling as enamored of Janey as he once was?
We did talk about that, and I didn't have room in my story to mention this. I was thinking I'm going to save this for a future story. I said, yeah, Mike, you know, Janie just, you know, she must have angered a lot of developers. I mean, she there's no more predictability or kind of taken all the predictability out of, or, you know, predictability out of real estate development in Boston. And it's so uncertain. And he had a very good response, which was, you know, this is a very, you know, it's a kind of a very difficult project. It is confounded many a mayor, including her. And so, and just felt that she was in a tough political position. And he didn't think that that this, you know, that her stance on this one particular project meant that she would overturn other development projects.
We're talking to Shirley Leung. Shirley, I loved your column. In fact, I texted you when you wrote this column about housekeepers. You can tell people what your advocacy position is on this thing. But, you know, well, why don't you describe to people what the facts are and what you were urging people who were hotel guests to do. And then I have a few thoughts about it.
Yeah, so this was my Labor Day column, and you know, I said, you know, if you want to help save a job, next time you check into a hotel, request daily housekeeping. Some of us who have started to travel again, you might notice that there hasn't been daily housekeeping during the throes of the pandemic, and now that we're coming out, some of these hotel chains like the Hilton, Hyatt, Marriott, they're taking this moment to get rid of daily housekeeping unless you request it. And so when you check into a hotel now, chances are you won't get housekeeping, daily housekeeping. They won't come in to make your bed or change your sheets or change your towels or straighten up unless you call the front desk. And so I wrote this column telling if you want to save someone's job, a housekeeper's job, request daily housekeeping. And Unite Here, the hotel union, has done a study on this, and they said that if this practice becomes permanent, getting rid of daily housekeeping, it could result in the loss of 39%, up to 39% of all hotel housekeeping jobs in the country. That's about 180,000 jobs, and a lot of these jobs are held by women and also and people of color. So women of color largely work at these jobs.
You know, the thing I wanted to say about this is I haven't been in a hotel in 2 years since the pandemic began. And so for those hotels who are arguing we're doing this so that we can keep you safe in the time of COVID, the scam before COVID on the part of these hotels was we don't want to have your towels changed every day because we're so concerned about the environment. The goal was they didn't want to pay the housekeepers to come in the damn rooms, and they were theoretically doing it for you. So I have to say, you know, if people are concerned particularly about low-paid workers, as you say, overwhelmingly women, overwhelmingly people of color, take your advice, not to mention the fact, isn't one of the reasons you stay in a hotel because you have everything new and clean and beautiful and your bed made every single day? That's the thing for me. Don't you love that, Marjorie, when you get back to your room?
I do.
And the bed's made up?
I do, but I said this to Jim before the show, Shirley. I think this may be a losing battle because I think a lot of people think they are doing the environmentally correct thing by not getting their towels replaced every day, because really you don't need to have your towels replaced every day. And then they think, well, you know, if I'm not going to get my towels, what the heck about the bed? I'd rather have nobody in my room.
You don't want a mint on your pillow when you come back to the room?
I think a lot of people would just rather not have the chambermaid coming into their room every day. And I speak as a former chambermaid. I did this for quite some time. I mean, it's a tough job, and I have great empathy for these women, but I think that this may be the future. I hate to say it, but I think it is.
Not if Shirley has her way.
Marjorie, you know, I would say half my reader emails agreed with me, and the other half raised this issue of the environment, but also they actually don't like it. They don't like someone coming into their room.
Yeah, so you always have to remember to put the do not disturb, or they're going to knock on your door.
What are you doing in the room?
You never know what you're doing in the room, Jim. I tell you, I found a lot of things in those rooms after I went in as a teenage chambermaid.
You know, when I talked to a hotel consultant who said, who agreed with you, Marjorie, saying that that this is it's a fait accompli that daily housekeeping will go away. I think what's going to happen now is if you want housekeeping, you're going to have to pay for it.
Yes, that's what I think, too.
And so the point of my column was, you know, we, the customers, we have a shot at getting hotels to reverse course. So now is the time to say something and I did have readers saying that they were pretty upset losing daily housekeeping. They are writing letters to the chain. And so I actually add one thing. So in the Boston market, there continues to be daily housekeeping at the union hotels here because the unions have fought for that. And they have fought for daily housekeeping to remain in Boston.
So when you wrote the piece about the Mannings, a couple that gave $50 million to UMass about a week or two ago, he's the chair of the board. Did you think that $50 million would seem like small change a week later, Shirley Young?
I did not think $50 million, but this is such a great, a week for the University of Massachusetts.
Boy, is it ever.
I wrote about Rob and Donna Manning, and Rob Manning has been the longtime head of MFS Investment, which is a Boston mutual fund company. It actually invented the mutual fund, and he's also been the longtime chair of the UMass Board of Trustees. He and his wife decided to give $50 million. The Marty Meehan, the president, UMass president, likes to point out to me, it is $50 million up front in cash all at once. It is already in our bank account, accruing interest and making money for us. And so he likes to say that this is what this gift is truly unique that way. But also, as of last week, it was the largest donation given to the UMass system, and it was eclipsed yesterday by billionaire Gerald Chan, who's giving $175 million. I think it's over 5 years to the UMass Medical School, and so this is huge for our public higher ed. As I wrote in my piece. Typically, you only have like the Harvards or the MITs. Some of these private institutions get these large checks because it becomes like almost a status symbol, right? To have a building named after you at a Harvard. But nobody gives. Few people give to UMass, and so it's great to see the Mannings and also Gerald Chan see the value of UMass. They educate so many students, and a lot of these students come from Massachusetts and they stay in Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's a big deal. Did you say a minute ago that MFS invented the mutual fund? Is that what you said?
Yeah, almost like a century ago, whatever, in the early 1900s.
Wow.
They are the oldest mutual fund company in the country. Rob Manning was a great interview because he was actually embarrassed by how much money people like him, how much money the wealthy have made. Through the stock market. And he's like, we were already very wealthy before, and now we are even more wealthy. And this is not right when all these people lost their jobs. So his message was, you know, rich people like me who made a lot of money in the stock market, give it away, give back, you know, you don't need it. You know, give to UMass and help, you know, and part of the his money also, the money that they gave, specifically, they wanted the money to close inequities.
Yep.
And so their first, it was very symbolic, their first batch of money, $15 million, again, upfront, all cash, went to UMass Boston Nursing School. And it will be renamed Robin, Donna Manning Nursing School. And Donna was worked at Boston Medical Center, she was an oncology nurse. So she saw firsthand how, she talked about how all the nurses looked like her, white. white, yet all the many of the patients were people of color. Mm-hmm. And so she wanted to educate the next generation of nurses, make them more diverse so that she could, so that generation can help close healthcare gap as well, healthcare inequities.
Well, you know what I love, too? It's a great story about both both the Chans and the Mangs. The Mangs were high school sweethearts, the first in their families to go to college. And as you say, she worked as a nurse all those years, just retired in 2018. And Chan, Gerald Chan, was an immigrant, grew up in Hong Kong, moved to Mass to go to Harvard, and his 101-year-old mother, I shouldn't say his late mother, used to be a nurse as well. So these are people that didn't land with the silver spoon, right, that did very well on their own right. Well, and
I think Chan came from a lot of money. He made his own money, but I think he had family wealth to begin with. And so, but they're giving, I mean, Chan also gave to the Harvard, I mean, it's known as the Chan School of Public Health.
He bought, what are you talking about? He bought Harvard Square, essentially. He owns
essentially he has a lot
Harvard
of money.
Square.
He does. And he also bought parts of Dorchester. Yeah, that's true. So, he's got a lot of money.
Well, the Mannings didn't have the silver spoon. Now let's go back.
The Mannings did not have a silver spoon. They're actually UMass Lowell alum.
Yeah.
You know, they're the first in their generation to go to college. I think they also were commuters. You know, they grew up in, I think they're from
Methuen.
And they commuted to Lowell. And so, they gave back. And they've been giving to the UMass Lowell system. But $50 million they outdid themselves with $50 million.
I guess so.
Shirley, it's good to talk to you. As always, really appreciate your time. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Shirley. Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young joins us every week. She's also a GBH contributor. Coming up, a coin shortage is creating loads of laundry problems. We're taking your calls, asking you, is it time to do away with not just coin-up laundry, but coin-operated everything? That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie. And for this segment, Marjorie, we're going to do a coin toss to determine what topic to take calls on.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much. The problem, there are no coins to toss. Another shortage created by the pandemic is a coin shortage. Today, there is no change to spare. It's creating chaos at the laundromat, as you mentioned, parking meters, and where else? That's what we're asking you. Where else in your life do you need coins to scratch off your scratch ticket? Where? 877-301-8970. Tell us your coin shortage stories. Make the case for doing away with change altogether if you want to, or if you're pro-change, which I know you are. You're at least pro-quarters, I think.
I have a lot of quarters in my car at all times, Jim.
We'll give you a penny for your thoughts or not. 877-301-8970. There's this great story at Boston.com. About how not only what the genesis of the coin shortage is, it's primarily a pandemic created kind of thing, but the conundrum, the problem that people are facing, particularly with laundromats, is this one guy who's quoted in the story who asked his landlord to waive all the fees for doing the wash because he couldn't get any quarters. There's another person in the story, also from Boston, whose parents, as a gift, gave the kid $40 worth of quarters for some, I don't know, a birthday or some such thing. And I hadn't thought much about it, but because we don't spend cash right now and because people are nervous about it anyway, essentially there is no change circulating. And that's the issue, by the way. It's not a coin shortage, according to the Mint and the Feds. It's a coin circulation kind of problem.
Well, you know what I love? The kid who said he's going around desperately trying to get quarters. Otherwise, he's going to have to drive 4 hours round trip to his parents' house again to do his laundry. I didn't realize this was a big deal. You know, I always have quarters for the meters. You know what I mean? It's my old reporter's habit, Jim, because it takes a lot longer to put your credit card in or even to use the app. Just stick those quarters in, it goes really, really quickly.
Well, the problem with the app, by the way, for those, it's one thing if you're in a park for 2 hours or something. If you're doing a short parking thing, the fee, usually it's 50 cents or something. So you spend 50 cents in the meter and you got to double it to pay for the app. So I have to say, I am one, we've had this discussion before, if they got rid of pennies, I think it'd be a great contribution to society. But I'm with you, I really like the quarter. I mean, I really, there's a
never
thing
have about, enough of them.
There's a thing about, and by the way, do we need nickels either? Could you do without nickels?
I could do without nickels. I could certainly do without pennies. I mean, what's the point of pennies?
No,
I don't
point.
Know.
No point about
I don't
pennies.
Know.
So
no
we,
point.
We want to discuss your coin shortage stories with you. How difficult has it been? How have you gotten around the problems? Or frankly, do you not give a damn? Peter in Waltham, you are first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling in. Hi.
Good afternoon, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey, Peter.
So we have some small apartment buildings, anywhere from 2 to 8 units, and many of them have coin-op laundries in the basement. Mm. Tenants have, over the last few years, have really demanded that as a, if you will, to call it an amenity for the building. Mm-hmm. So we put them in. Commercial laundry equipment is about probably 3 times as much as a home unit.
Mm-hmm.
It's generally a break-even thing, at least for a long time, as far as being a laundry owner. But right now, all of our machines take quarters. And we get calls from tenants saying, I can't get any quarters. I've been to the bank. They don't have any.
So what do you do?
I like to do my laundry. So our practice has now been, every time we go collect quarters from the machine, we take a certain amount of those. We put them aside. We bag them ourselves into like $10 or $20 units. And the tenant calls. We say, okay, we'll meet you in an hour. You know, they give us a $10 bill. I give them a bag of quarters.
That is great.
Everybody's
you got a
happy.
Buddy. You got a buddy in the story that does the exact same thing. This tenant called the property manager telling him he couldn't do the laundry. He asked if his laundry was going to be for free. And he sold the kid $40 worth of quarters.
Well, selling means he gives him $40,
stash.
Just like with Peter. I love that. How often are you doing that? Like a lot?
Sometimes it's like, you know, it seems like it's once a week. Sometimes it's a little less often, you know. But I try to give people enough. I say, you want $30 or $40 a quarter? That'll last you a little longer. And so
hey, Peter, hold on for a second.
Sure, yeah.
I had to go to a laundromat last summer, and I was stunned by how much it cost to do a load of laundry. I don't know what it's like in your building, but it was like $4 or $5 just to do one load of laundry. It's expensive.
Yeah, it's gotten more and more. I mean, the problem is how much the machines cost, and then up front, I mean, you can be talking, $900, $1,000, $1,200 for a machine, depending on what's in it.
Peter, if I met you after the show and gave you $10, can I get quarters from you or no?
I have to go count that, Jim, but
okay.
I think we can do the deal.
I'll get back to you. Peter, thank you for the call. How do you like it? An amenity of a good small landlord is to give you a bag of quarters for a $10 bill.
I love it. I tell you, laundromats are tough. I get why people want to keep. Remember lugging all your laundry to the laundromat, Jim, back in the day? I mean, you know.
Those were the bad old days.
Those are the bad old days, exactly. Joe from New Bedford, thank you for calling.
Hello, Joe.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Thank you for calling.
Second time caller. I just want to chat in my point on the coin thing.
Please.
I think we need the quarters. I'm a bachelor.
Yeah.
And my apartment doesn't have clothes facilities. So I go to a nice clean place in Fairhaven that takes quarters still. And they have change machines. But it is so nicer than the card operated laundromats, which the majority are, and it never balances out. The laundry is like $3.50 and you can only pay $4 on the card. So that's like chiming on that. I think we need the coins.
Now, Joe, do you find, in addition, that most laundromats serve a dual purpose? One, you do your laundry, and two, you meet people. Is that not, it's like a hangout kind of thing, is it not?
Not for me. I occasionally run into a friend because I'm from New Bedford, but I grew up in Fairhaven. I throw it in my laundry, so I run into people that I know there. But other than that, I'm usually... Okay, I got 30 minutes. Now I got 30 minutes to go get breakfast and then come back and put it in the dryer, you know?
You're just taking care of business. We appreciate
exactly.
that. Joe, thank you very much for the call. When was the last time you did your clothes in a public laundromat, Marjorie?
Last summer.
Is that true? Oh, you just said that to Peter. Why did you do that?
Because I didn't want to overload the... I was worried about the septic system. If you did have a lot of laundry to
thing?
Do that day, I didn't want to overload the septic system. Yeah, and it was... I thought to myself... you know, because there's a lot of people that look like they are down on their luck at the local laundromat, and you think, God, they could buy a washing machine
For the amount of quarters.
Yeah, it's so expensive now to do laundry in a laundromat. A lot of people do that. They just drop it off. You see a lot of people in nice suits and nice cars that just drop the laundry off there because they probably don't have a washer dryer in their apartment. Robert says he needs those quarters for the Motel 6 vibrating bed when he travels. He said he could produce a doctor's note if needed.
How many quarters do you carry in your car at all time? Of course, you have no idea, right?
Well, I routinely go in and get $20 worth of quarters. So I probably have it. Yes.
Because, but wait a second. But this part of what this story in Boston.com says is not only, unlike the old days, where if you needed a roll of quarters, you go to the closest bank and give them $10. Now, is it $10? Yeah, it is $10 for 40 quarters.
Right.
The bank will say, if you don't do your business here, I can't do it. But this story goes ahead to say that even some people who banked at Bank of America went to their local branch and they didn't have any quarters. I mean,
I go to small banks, Jim. My small bank has been doing very well on
the quarter front.
It's from being a reporter all those years. You know, you get in the habit of running around, dump the quarters in the meter, dump the quarters in the meter really quickly. Because I say it's faster, at least for me, than doing the app or the credit card. Steve in Watertown.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Hi, Steve here.
Hi, we know that. That's why we said hi, Steve.
How are you doing?
Oh, but whatever. Hi.
The coin thing. I still pile up everything, even pennies. I just separate them at home, and I put them in their separate bins.
Ooh,
and what I do
that.
When they get to be too much, I take them over to a Coinstar machine and dump them all in. When you separate nickels, dimes, and quarters and pennies, the machine can swallow them quicker. And I've done that, and I've actually walked away with almost $100.
Now, Steve, have you thought of standing outside a laundromat and selling quarters for a premium just to make a couple of bucks on the side?
No, you know, I have not, because you know what I do? I do what Marjorie does. I keep a bunch of quarters in my car, too, for parking meters.
Yeah.
You know, Steve, you don't use Coinstar is not how you do this, right?
Yes, it's a machine.
It takes seven cents out of every dollar that you saved for the fee. Don't you find that to be a problem?
I don't care. I don't mind that. You're recycling the coins and you're getting paper money back.
Okay.
I'm willing to pay the fee that they charge.
Well, apparently
one
you
other
are.
Thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
One other thing a while back, Marjorie.
What?
Or is it Marguerite?
It's called Marjorie. It doesn't matter.
It just sounds like he says that.
What's that again, Steve?
I'm so with you on the flannel sheet thing that the topic was a while back. I tried to call back then, but I ran out of time.
Flannel sheets.
Yes.
Well,
or the wet sheets. We were hoping you'd call on the flannel sheet story.
We're glad you finally did, Steve. Thank you very much for the call. I have to say, in the old days, well, Steve is still doing this now. In the old days, it was great satisfaction when you had a ton of coins and you took it to a machine. Now, by the way, most banks, if you went to your own bank, I don't know if they do this anymore, they didn't charge you if you gave them a bag of coins and they put it in their coin counter and they just gave you your money. That was a pretty great satisfaction. But in the time of the coin shortage, that's not an available proposition for most people.
I assume you brought the pennies in with your children as opposed to going in yourself with the pennies, Jim? Or was that a family activity? Or
Maybe I did. Did you do that yourself? No, you know.
Here comes Jim with all his pennies.
Can we talk about the pennies for one second before we go back to the calls? We have said, you and I have said repeatedly, we're not the only ones, we should get rid of pennies. What is the argument for not getting rid of pennies?
I don't know. Kate just says she lived in Canada for a few years and they phased out pennies and it was fantastic. And she said it wasn't a big deal at all.
Well, didn't we also read last time we talked about pennies on the air? Didn't we read that they cost more to make? Am I wrong about this? They cost more to make than the cost of the penny? Or is that another coin?
I don't know, Jim. I'm not
sure. Can you look that up and let me know?
I'll look it up.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Rob in Newburyport. We're talking about the coin shortage that we're all suffering through in the time of the pandemic. What's up there?
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Hey.
I wasn't planning to call on this, but since you just mentioned it, it's true. It costs us more to make a penny than a penny's worth.
Well, thank you.
You can Google that. What prompted me to call was I was with somebody. We were at DCU this weekend, and DCU actually not only took the coins in, but they gave the person a few points, a little, like interest, on top of the deposit for depositing the coins at the bank.
Because they need him so badly?
Yeah, apparently.
What credit union is that? What's DCU?
DCU, Digital Credit Union.
Oh, Digital Credit Union. Okay.
Yeah, it's not even my bank. It's my girlfriend's bank. Anyway, the third reason I'm calling is my company invented a new kind of parking meter that works like Easy Pass. It doesn't take quarters. You just enter your license plate and your credit card into an app. They're in Dedham. They're over at Tufts University. And basically, just read your license plate. Your license plate is your permit to park in Dedham or Tufts for the rest of your life. Every time you go through there, it just takes a little bit off your account. So there's no quarters required. No touching required.
That's excellent.
No touching required. Rob, thank you very much for the call. One of our colleagues said someone just posted in the Davis Square Facebook page that our coworker is in, asking where to get quarters for laundry because their bank is limiting them to one $10 roll at
really?
A time. How weird.
God, we're
is
rationing
this?
Quarters.
Apparently we
what
are.
What does it come to in the
By
United
the way,
States
why do
America?
We have change at all anymore? Do you have any idea? Why do we have change at all?
I don't know. You do see, somebody just emailed before and said, you see a lot of people at the grocery store that are still paying in cash. Not many.
No, I didn't say cash. Some. I didn't say cash.
Well,
I said change.
Well, they got their whole little, don't you ever get behind, and this is, you know, often it's someone that's quite elderly, will have a little change purse, mm-hmm. and they'll be counting out the pennies. Haven't you ever had that happen, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
Counting out the pennies, counting out the nickels.
I'm usually everybody, that person, yes. That's I know it very well, actually.
Yeah, everyone behind them is going crazy.
What
okay.
I thought you were continuing there. Elliot in Hamilton,
not.
You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi, Elliot.
Hey, guys. Thanks a lot for having me. First time caller, long time listener.
We love that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I don't consider myself an old person yet, but I am calling in defense of the penny.
Beautiful. Go ahead.
Every day I'll buy myself a coffee. It costs $1.06, and it gives me a little bit of satisfaction just to walk in there, plop down my $1.06 right on the counter, and walk right out and save 10 whole seconds from my morning instead of having to get my credit card out and do it that way.
Now, where do you get coffee for a buck plus tax?
My beautiful local Cumberland Farms.
Oh, exactly. Okay.
Oh. I always hear about Cumberland Farms coffee. That's the huge coffee. What does it cost you for the huge coffee, Elliot?
99 cents plus tax is $1.06.
Wow,
99 cents
good.
Plus tax. Yeah, my sister is a huge fan.
Yeah, you end up with enough cash in your, cup holder in your car to pay for your coffee. Kind of feels like you're not paying for it at all.
You know, Elliot, exact change is a really satisfying thing. I mean, I could almost speak. It's almost erotic in some ways for some people. It's very satisfying, isn't it? When you have the exact, like the $1.06 thing.
I can hardly contain myself.
I can tell. No, I can. That's why I brought it up. I knew it excited you. Elliot, thank you for your call. We appreciate that.
Berwick says several times recently we've redeemed coins at Discount Change Ocean State Job Lot because they'll give you a 40% bonus for coins in store credit. He says his son brings home
That's
chips
incredible.
And coins. His wife rolls them up and they split the bonus.
Didn't Oliver North, when he was in trouble, testify in front of Congress that the place he got the money, this is before he got in trouble, well, didn't he say in front of Congress the place he got the money to build the security fence around his property was he saved his extra change? Wasn't that his argument?
I do not know.
Remember
I do
what,
not
you
know.
Don't remember what
but
I'm
didn't
talking
you tell
about?
Me you had a big jar when your kids were little in your house?
Oh, I used to save. We used to pay for trips, part of trips, because I would do the exact opposite of what Elliot would do. Even if I had the 6 cents, I'd give the $2 so that I get 94 cents in change. It's not that much money, and it adds up and adds up and adds up, and you get a huge amount of money. But who deals in cash anymore, particularly in a pandemic? When was the last time you paid for something in cash? Probably yesterday, knowing you. When?
I haven't done it for a while, actually.
Really?
I haven't done it for a while. I'm just sticking the credit card in the machine, which is kind of weird when you think about it. Josh from Rhode Island.
Why is it weird to stick a credit card in a machine?
Because it's weird to pay for every, you know, to buy a cup of coffee with a credit card seems weird to me.
Not to me.
Josh from Rhode Island, what
hey,
do you
Josh.
Think? Is it weird or not weird?
Go ahead, Josh.
Hey, guys, what's going on? Long-time caller, first-time listener.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's an old joke. Kind of.
I like that. Marjorie missed it, but I like it.
I got it.
Go ahead.
I got it.
Okay. No, I'm the same way. You know, I have the Poland Spring 3-gallon jug, whatever, at home, and I just keep throwing whatever coins are in my pocket at the end of the day, and eventually it fills up. And, the Ocean State Job Lot thing is actually what I was calling about.
Oh, tell.
I definitely have $100 in coins. And if you buy a gift card and they give you that additional 40%.
That is huge.
That's a $140 gift card for $100.
Wow.
That is a big deal.
So what do you do? Do you roll in your Poland Springs container, or do you count them out yourself, or how do you work it?
Well, I haven't done it yet. That's what I was thinking about. You know, how am I going to help out and recirculate these coins that I personally have been hoarding, when you think of it that way. But yeah, I'll probably roll them, bring them in, and see what they give me. It's definitely a lot better than the negative 7% that you get when you go to CoinStar.
That is brilliant. That is really. Let us say, Josh, when you have that experience, let us know how it feels to get the $40 on the $100 worth of coins. That's a pretty exciting prospect, isn't it, Marjorie?
It's a very exciting prospect. Now, John says, and we trust he's correct here, that it costs 7.42 cents to make a nickel and 1.76 cents to make a penny.
Well, there you go. I was right about it. It's amazing, isn't it? Wow. So are those not two good reasons? And by the way, not only are pennies useless, nickels weigh too much, don't they?
They are heavier. They are heavier than dimes, aren't they?
Yes, yes. They're twice as big. They're bigger and heavier. It's a very deep kind of thing that I really don't feel like I want to explain at this point.
Ted from Marshfield says, for an erotic time, you do is you pay for your Q-tips with the exact change.
Man, let me tell you something. I can't even talk about that on the air without getting in trouble. So thanks for bringing it up, but we'll talk after the show.
Thank you, Ted.
Okay, that's it, Marjorie. We are done.
Okay, Jim.
Thank you very much. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I hope you tune in tomorrow. We're going to be joined by the U.S. ambassador to France, who will talk to him about the global reverberations of 9/11. Of course, Chuck Todd, our regular Thursday guest from Meet the Press, will join us to discuss the spectrum of political things that are happening everywhere. I want to thank our crew. That includes Zoe Matthews, Aidan Connolly, Mackenzie Farkas, Rebecca Tauber. Our engineer is John McLeod Parker. Our offsite engineer is Dave Goldstein. Now, I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. She just stepped off for a second there. We hope you'll join us tomorrow. We really appreciate you being with us today. Have a great afternoon. It's beautiful. It appears out. And we'll see you tomorrow at 11. Bye.